Level 20, Episode 21, Romance Part 2. I'm Connor Smith, Level 1 intern. If you haven't seen Romance yet, go watch it before listening to this episode. It is available on all the digital platforms you could think of: iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Vimeo, Xbox Marketplace, anywhere you could want to find it. Start of this episode, Friedel and I did an interview just this past week with Lucas Stahl Madison. Talked with him for about 40 awesome minutes, and then we have a 2.5 hour final conversation with Josh Friedel and I, opening up the mailbag and a long conversation about Romance, Level 1's 20th and final annual movie. Just a reminder, movies 1 through 9, Balance through Turbo, are still online and available for you to watch for free at podcast.level1.ski. You can find a link on there to the Vimeo channels with all of the movies. All 20 of our movies are always available to rent or buy on digital platforms such as Vimeo, and all DVDs except for Romance are only $5 on our store at www.level1.ski. So go check that out. If there's a movie you want to watch, you're listening to these podcasts after the fact, go check them out. Here we go, episode 21. Here's Lucas Stahl Madison.
I don't care.
How's Aura, man? It looks like winter up there.
Yeah, it's like almost 30 centimeters, maybe. How? Yeah. We're gonna go power surfing tomorrow.
Nice.
Yeah. Apparently, you know the Fita board studio boards, the one I had in Japan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Henrik Winstedt like managed to get like 5 of his early prototypes. So he has like 5 boards that we're gonna share tomorrow.
Team Palsurfing.
Yeah.
Did you get to do much of that in Japan as well, Lucas?
Yeah, I wish we did more, but I mean, you always wish you did more power surfing, but we got some really dank power surfing in. Yeah.
We had like
We did the cat skiing with power surfing. I mean,
damn, that's luxury right there.
Yeah.
We dedicated 2 days on Parker's behest, I think, most important. that was like the palate cleanse between filming. It was really good. One day cat skiing at you and I, and then one day this other place we were at that, it was great.
Word up.
Asai dake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Friedel, we've covered that this was like your first year going to Japan shooting for Romance, but Lucas, I know you've been there a couple years, I think. What was your history with traveling to Japan?
This was my second year there.
Okay.
I did my first experience last year. Like most people, falling in love with that country. And it was awesome to see Friedel's first year too. It was super nice. I mean, the trip we had was amazing dinners. We met this dude, Goro, who has a restaurant there up in Hokkaido. Mm. And we would just like go skiing POW, and then we would go back down to the town we're staying at and like go straight to his restaurant, and he would have like, yeah, today I'm serving this. We would just like sit in the couch like, yes.
Yeah, little wood burning stove.
Yeah.
Some coffee and hot veggie soup or whatever he was making that day. It's pretty.
And some like he had some dank magazines that we were like scrolling through.
Oh, like ski magazines or just like
everything. Yeah, like ski magazines and like art magazines, all kinds of stuff.
The print is really alive in Japan. Like I was geeking out. I actually filled like my bag up excess weight with print magazines because there's so many publications there that are like just works of art. So much beautiful photography, snowboard, skiing, art, whatever.
Yeah, word.
Lucas, something Parker mentioned when we talked to him for one of these episodes was that you had like some stuff on your hit list left from filming from Yugen that you like wanted to tick off going to Japan.
Was there, I'm curious which of any shots that you got this year from that trip were like stuff you were manifesting beforehand?
I would definitely say this one hit up in Asai Dake, that we, I think it was like first or second day we got there.
First day.
Yeah, did we go?
You're talking switch nine hit?
Switch nine, yeah.
Because
We went to that zone last year, and I did a 360 on it. And yeah, it's just like easy takeoff, step down, pretty nice. And yeah, that was one that was in my mind beforehand for sure.
That's dank. That was one of the clips I wanted to ask you about, because that... The shot, the like B-roll portrait of you with the nosebleed, like in front of that.
Yeah, so just like, it was first hit.
Mm-hmm.
And the landing was not super steep. TBQH. And
deep, but not steep.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, just the classical nose to knee.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it was because you landed right next to that tree, too, which is super crazy and always strikes me about that shot.
No, just a good old smash in the face.
But the trees are real there when you're trying to send it, because Parker, it's not really, it wasn't fully documented, but Parker, when he does the 180 in the Japan segment, he skis really fast backwards into a massive perch tree.
And yeah, dude. Like, I got some Steel Spence vibes. I was like, yo, damn.
Yeah, sketchy. It made such a loud noise, just his like ass hitting this tree, basically.
Oof.
Like, scary.
Yeah.
Holy. That motherfucker takes some hits, though. I don't know how he does it, because like, I feel like I would have been like had a shattered pelvis or something.
Yeah, I want to ask you guys about, or Frito, I guess, about his tomahawk. Was that like, did he like ski after that, or because I never asked?
That's Parker a good question it. Because we didn't actually cover that with him or in general. That's a natural feature in the Whistler backcountry. He's going for 180 there, for the record. He did like the paid in late three out to try to, because he just had, I don't know, three times as much airtime as he expected. And then obviously first hit as well. And then a tomahawk is the most violent thing maybe I've ever filmed. And it's actually, there's some audio there I recorded after when he's talking to Darkness after the crash that I didn't have any use for, like a way to use it. But the way he describes that crash is horrifying, because he's basically like, yeah, I felt like I was in a black hole where like the forces of gravity were like pulling everything, like pulling my body into different directions. Like,
dude, imagine the G-forces on that.
Oh yeah. Like, he's like, yeah, I felt like I was in this like black hole washing machine where like I was being drawn and quartered, and I could feel like every different part of my body being pulled in different directions.
Dude.
And then he was completely fine. And he...
What? He was?
Yeah, like he sat down for 15 minutes, and then he actually was so pissed that he tried to hit that thing again. And he crashed like two more times. Not nearly as violent, but it was insane.
Dude, it's definitely one of those like hype shots in the movie.
Yeah, it was a hype shot even before that, because we threw it on the gram maybe couple days after we filmed it. We're like, I was like, fuck it, like let's just throw one out there for the people. Like, this is the most crazy crash we've got. Let's just feed the sharks. And sure enough, it was on like all these viral ripoffs sites, probably got a couple hundred like thousand views or some shit.
The Barstool Sports coverage.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, speaking of that, Lucas, you know, that's the same thing going on almost to a different extent with your Rick Scranton train deck crash.
Yeah, that got a lot of traction, huh?
people are definitely reacting to that one, if nothing else.
Did he mean to do that, or?
Yeah, can you walk us through your brain, like, in that moment? What the hell happened there?
So I was, like, thinking about this, like, front flip trick onto a, you know, what do you call it, like, this cheese grater, or what do you guys call that in English? You know, the, like, snow box type.
Yeah, feature. Like a butter pad.
Yeah, butter pad type thing. And I had, like, this front flip trick in mind, and it was basically our last day of shooting in Rikskrinsen and for the season. And I was like, okay, if it's one time I'm gonna do it, it's here. And then I had just tried it, like tried the feature like 2-3 times maybe, and I was scared shitless. And and you know, sometimes you just feel like you have to go for it because you get too scared later, sort of. And so I just sent it, and there was no airtime up to it, sort of. So I just like under rotated and like did this crazy slide and landed on my feet. It was like, what in the world happened? And then Bjorn got the shot really nice, and it was like just this super fun. Like, as soon as we watched it, we were like, yeah, that's like, you can't beat that. That's like too crazy. And so I just popped a beer and then called it the season.
Yeah, and we hit the train back to Stockholm the next day. Like, it's a 16-hour train ride back from Rikskrinsen to Stockholm. Yeah. We were watching. I remember being in the little dining car in the train watching Bjorn shot like probably 20 times in a row.
Yeah.
But what did you want to actually get out of that? I guess you were being very silent about that trick at the time, because I think you just wanted to shut up and do it. But
Yeah. Well, I had like 4 different variations that I sort of been thinking about. But the front flip to tail press, or like tail manual, was the original idea.
So it was close to the actual thing.
It was close. It just got a little bit more mental than I thought. my head is just super close to that brick, or not brick, like concrete, or whatever.
It's so close. But the should be noted about that feature is that we did not build that. Magnus Granier and Benjamin
Carlin.
Carlin and Oliver Carberg built that feature the day before, and those guys were just going crazy on it, like building that crazy cheese wedge onto the deck. And we actually had been skiing all week, like filming all week, and then we went to the club that night to see Gunther, who's this crazy early 90s throwback artist. But we walked out of the club at 2. It's still light out, of course, because it's the late May in Rikskrinsen, and walked up to the train deck, and first thing I see is Magnus do a backflip onto that thing. I was like, what the fuck?
That was insane.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are filming at 2:30 in the morning on that.
Do a backflip onto that was crazy. And yeah, that whole story, how they built, because the snow was sort of low from like up to the top, and they like used like garbage bags or something to like with a rope or something to pull up that snow on top.
Holy shit.
It's just this huge build. I mean, it's not super clear in the shot, but the takeoff is actually like really high and like
probably
skinny.
12 feet high or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, skinny. Like a aerial jump.
Yeah.
Damn.
But they were very motivated to do that.
To like sort of a flat landing, and then it's like a couple feet, and then just like a wall of birch trees.
Jesus. So I haven't seen Eleanor yet, but I assume that feature has a heavy presence in that movie then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, especially. Should we tell him about Magnus Chat or? Yeah. Well, he did a link on slash backflip onto the top of the tunnel, and then a three out. So he basically like lands the backflip and then boom pops a three out of it. It's insane.
Damn.
Yeah.
And then I think Oliver's clip in the Le Wonder is beautiful too.
Mm-hmm.
It's so
the
nice.
Up carve, yeah.
Mm.
And he had been really trying, like, you know, because he was at Rick's at the same time, and obviously, like, he's been in Level 1 movies before and super known and all that. He really wanted to get a clip in the movie for sure. I wanted to get a clip of him as well, but he almost got a really nice flat spin on the quarter pipe session, but that butterpad shot is dope, and Bjorn got a really good shot of it as well. I was just shooting the back angle, but so nice. But you can also check out the Suede movie as well. So, like, that's the Swedish crew, the young gun crew.
Yeah.
Suede site, at Suede site. Mm. That's Oliver and Anton, Benjamin.
Vilmer.
Vilmer.
Yeah.
That's going to be dope to have, like, another Swedish crew that's also pretty hot coming up behind you guys.
Yeah, it was cool. Like, the Riksgränsen spring scene is actually really cool. It's sort of like all the, for film skiing, like all the crews sort of come up there in May.
Mm.
And it's like snowboard crews, ski crews, and some sled crews too.
Damn, that's sick.
Like, people are tenting, people are staying at the hotel. It's just like this whole vibe and then the midnight sun and everything.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. What, you just mentioned a little while ago that you did have like four different front flip variations in mind. How often is that the case that you have multiple like different variations of a trick that you're thinking about in your head? Because I think that's, I don't know how common that is.
I have a bunch of notes, a bunch of tricks, you know, just like, yeah, in my head or whatever.
Mm.
And it's a lot about the feature when you do a trick too. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're in the backcountry, it's like natural features. And so the feature often decides you know, if the trick is even possible, but also a trick can be easier on a feature that fits it really well. So I don't try to fight it too much. Like, it can be a trick that I really, really want, but if the feature is just not lined up for it, then I will try something else.
Yeah, word. One of the tricks I wanted to ask specifically about is the, like, super tweaked safety that's obviously on the cover of the fucking movie. Like, what was there a feature you were waiting for? Like, how long had that one been in the back of your head or inside your journal waiting to come out?
Well, the tweak safety, you know, sort of backside air method style ski trick, is just one of those tricks that is like really hard to do. And, I will like try it a bunch of times, really. I haven't tried it too much in the backcountry. I've tried it maybe like three times, but it has never really come out as I want it to look.
Mm.
And I'm still like, I did one obviously in on the hit in Kleppen in my segment.
Right.
But I'm still. Still waiting for that, you know, the one method. It's a life in progress, or what do you say? It's a work in progress.
Mm.
You know, I talked to a snowboarder about the method, and he was like, "Yeah, I mean, there's like five people that can do a real method."
it's I just heard this as well yesterday, but it has to do with flexibility, because some people don't have the flexibility to properly poke their legs out and do the arch as well. It takes this perfect combination with the right like air trajectory to be able to do it. Because I have tried numerous methods on a snowboard, and I am just like, I can't ever get that true arch on it. Like it's really that poke combination.
Yeah.
When it comes together, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, you know, on the like bikes and you cross, you know, those dirt bikes with the engine. They do this like big tweaks. It's almost like 180 and like upside down kind of, and then back to forward. I mean, that is just like so beautiful.
Mm. Yeah.
But it is like, I also tried like on snowboard a bit, and it's something with that trick also, you know, how it feels, because it's not just like that it looks good and blah, 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 people trying to push it, but it's also like, seems to be one of those tricks that, you know, like a switch five or something that's like so nice to do.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess one other trick, I don't want to keep like pulling these out, but because I could do it all day, but like the Rick Scranton nose pick rodeo 5 is so fucked up, man. Where did that get inspired or influenced from? I'm very curious.
That's been a long time in the making. Mm. I've had some tricks, like some of those tricks in Love One Segi has been, you know, in the notebook for, you know, a lot of years actually. And I don't know if you remember, but Henrik did one a couple years ago for his, I can't remember what that movie was, but I think it was his first own movie.
Mm.
And he did a nose pick, Misty 5, in Rick Scranton also. Mm. So I've had it in the notebook for a long time, but I also knew that that one was definitely possible because Henrik did it. So, but it was still a super scary one, kind of, or not kind of actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one in particular is kind of interesting because that was also the very first day we arrived.
Oh yeah. That was the day we arrived.
The overnight train from Stockholm. On like May 17th or something, show up in Rick's. It's beautiful and sunny out and like 20 degrees Celsius, which is really rare, you know, up there. And everyone's like partying at Opry on the deck when we got off the train at like 4:30 in the afternoon. And then we moved into the hostel and got some food and then hiked up the mountain because the lifts weren't even running anymore. And Lucas was just like, yeah, let's hit this rock. It was just Lucas and Crypto and I.
Mm.
And Crypto was like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. I don't know what to do here. And I wasn't even sure either. And then, yeah, you just started warming up those nose picks. And then that particular shot was like at 10:30 p.m. And it was the last bit of sun before it sort of dips below the mountain horizon.
Mm.
Yeah, it was literally the last try before the sun went down.
Uh-huh.
It was like when I hiked back up, the sun was down. So it was yes, good start. All right.
Yeah, good start for sure.
Yeah, the universe smiled that day.
Yeah. Crypto was trying some crazy, he tried one crazy ass nose picks type maneuver as well, but did not land it. It's in the trailer.
Right.
Yeah, dude, that one is. He does like the butter 3 type thing before, and then just because Crypto is in like Crypto and Mango and these types of dudes, they just go for things. I mean, it's insane. And on this try, Crypto just like goes up on his noses and just like pops out, and he just like flies like way like. Lands like after the landing and just
skis popped off. He almost hit a rock.
Damn.
Yeah. That was a pretty interesting way to start off things though. Pretty proper in a lot of ways.
Yeah. What I'm curious, like, is all these shit that's been in your notebook for a while that influenced this part. What were some of the bigger riders out there influencing you in putting this together?
It's been a lot of influence during the years, but I mean, long story short, and Teddy Bear Crisis was my first two movies.
Mm.
And those were like huge influences. I mean, literally like the thing that got me into skiing. So, I mean, basically everyone that's in Long Story Short had like huge influence on me. I mean, and especially like Liam Downey, I would say, you know, Corey Vanuler, Stephen Thomas, maybe it'd be the top three riders that sort of set the stage for what I wanted to do. Because you had like the, those were like style gods, you know?
Mm.
Like really? Stephen Thomas, like seven no grab, or switch five no grab and yeah. seven
uncrossed one.
Yep. And then the switch one, and you know, those sort of things. Like, because I hadn't really, like, I didn't really know anything about free skiing before that.
Mm.
I just had a friend that was like doing backflip and 720 on the little slope there where I'm from. And so, and that was just like, what is this world about? and then actually it's pretty funny because we're doing the podcast, but I mean, the Long Story Short, director commentary.
Mm.
I mean, I've told you, Friedel, a bunch of times about this, but I mean, I thought that was really cool because you see these movies and you see like the, you know, the sort of the superstar thing, and then to hear like some of the background stories was really cool.
Yeah, it's a totally different perspective on it for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, even just like I was just telling Connor, but we just released the Romance Podcast Part One where Connor's interviewing Keegan and Hornbeck and Wiley. Like, I've been obviously on the inside of things for a very long time, but hearing like Hornbeck's perspective on filming. It's something I haven't even heard out of his own mouth like that. It's like, holy shit, this is amazing. I'm loving this.
What was he saying?
I gotta listen to it. It's awesome.
Yeah. Hornbeck is amazing.
Yeah.
Love that kid.
I gotta check back in on that Long Story Short director's commentary. That'd be a trip. Definitely haven't heard that one. Since we recorded it in 2006.
Riedel, from your end, what were there any big influences on the editing in this segment, in Lucas's segment in particular?
I mean, the influence was Lucas, and also just kind of the coming together of so many elements that I've basically just been subliminally kind of just waiting to see like so many years. This is just like, oh, like where has this been? And I think that started when we were like starting off filming in Japan. And it was like, oh yeah. Like this, you know, he's somebody that can like, you know, I've filmed Powder for however many years, but this is, you really like it when somebody can like come in and just make something their own entirely. So that's like very special. And immediately it's like, yep, this is speaking to me. So editing that part and with that song was definitely like just a culmination of things that really speak to me. And I was like, it brought me great joy. That's for sure.
Word up. Yeah. Where'd that song come from?
It came from Shuey, actually, who heard it from, I think, John Hartman. That was like their super low-key party song, like kind of just, I don't know, like this sleeper song. The artist is called Dinner, who's like a experimental music producer from Denmark, actually. But he made this very strange pseudo-80s album a couple of years ago. Called Psychic Lovers, I believe. Anyway, I've had that song in my pocket for a couple of years, and and it's one of these songs where it's like, oh, this is like one of my favorite songs, but like you never want to always use your favorite songs for a movie because you might ruin it. And this definitely has not ruined it, because I actually just watched this part or I watched the movie, but I watched this part like 2 days ago, and I was like, oh, I actually really love this part so much.
Yeah, how does it... that's awesome to hear, and that's sick. Lucas, how do you feel when you watch it, man?
I mean, it's insane. Because, you know, level one was how I started getting into skiing.
Mm.
And so I had, like, I'd say I have the two biggest things in my ski career. And, you know, has been the first time I got the segment in the movie on Partly Cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
And then this obviously is like the big dream of a film skier to get an Ender segment in a level one movie. I mean, it's insane. I mean, it's just like the top. I mean, it's the coolest thing ever. Really, just like so proud to that happened. And I mean, it was super cool to work with Friedel for such a long time.
Mm.
We filmed a lot. And it's just one of those years where it came together really nice. Yeah. And then Japan. I mean, I filmed, I don't know how many like percent of my footage was from Japan, but we just had a Japan trip of our lives. It was so good, dude. And hard to redo something like that.
Yeah, for sure. I wish I could have been there for that Stockholm premiere of this movie, because seeing this, such a big Swedish presence at the end of the movie with the Rick segment into you. I'm sure that went fucking off.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
Dude, yeah. The Stockholm premiere was super lit. I just sort of like threw it together, and then this homie came out with a contact to this dope cinema that's like this like nice sort of cozy space.
Mm.
And then all these like sort of Swedish ski legends came out, and like all these old ski bums and like people that haven't like watched ski movies for a long time. And yeah, it was really cool.
Damn. Yeah, this is a good movie to get back into it with, in my opinion, at least. Yeah.
The thing, it was super crazy to get that Ender segment also, because it was such good skiing. Like, people went full force this year.
Yeah.
It was so good to see everybody, just everything from Keegan to like the crazy backcountry segment and like Parker and Dark's segment together. I mean,
yeah,
the skiing and some crazy filming with the drones, and I mean, yeah,
wild. Yeah, it was all in for sure.
Yeah, word up.
But I don't think I mentioned that you had the Ender until you probably saw it in High Fives, though.
Really?
Yeah. So funny thing there. I had no idea. But I actually knew a couple days before High Five, because I'm in this like Star Wars group on Instagram with like the Vayu brothers and
German.
Yeah, and Valley.
Valley.
Yeah, so Alex, yeah. He like he went to the Salt Lake City premiere, maybe?
Mm.
It was like wrote a message that was hilarious. Like, oh my god, I was on mushrooms last night and I saw your end of part. I was like, oh my god. It's like, what? What are you saying right now? Ender, what? So I didn't know 100% if it was Ender or not, because he was on mushrooms, but. So I didn't like dare to ask anyone. I just kept it cool and then saw it finally at High Fives.
Damn.
Word.
Friedel, why'd you keep it down low once it got finalized and the movie was out?
Because I think it's more special that way.
I'm hyped you did it, actually.
I've been waiting 20 years to see that shit. I don't want to blow it till they see themselves.
Lucas, are you done filming Street for good?
Good question. I would say no, but I also said that I were gonna film Street this year, but I don't know. Maybe some Spring Street would be nice.
Mm.
But right now I'm just fully in love with the powder. And also trying to do some power surfing more. So my focus is like powder skiing and power surfing.
All good things.
Yeah.
For sure. Where is the season going to take you filming for the new Bunch movie?
It's super unclear at the moment. I actually haven't finalized anything, and it's like just the most open it's ever been. So I can't really
say. That's not a bad thing.
We've been talking about Sochi.
Oh.
Yeah, Sochi is like really dang for backcountry.
It is. It's like big Japan.
Have you been?
No, but I used to study that place because I was very curious about it. There's some great snowboarding that's been filmed there and skiing as well. But it can rain. It's low elevation and kind of warmer climate.
Pretty far
there, but
south.
Yeah, but when they get snow, it is the way I've heard it described to me, and I think maybe even Paul or somebody is talking about it, but it's like exactly like if Japan met the Alps or something.
Ooh. Yeah. Connor, have you seen Pollard's movie?
No, I also haven't seen that. I just watched the trailer a couple of days ago, but I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I mean, wow. That's like my biggest fear with Russia is the whole Pollard thing. And to see that whole story he's been working on for like 4 years or whatever. And like his whole artistic vibe and everything he's done, just all put together in this beautiful flick. Mm. I mean, it was probably the most artistic and beautiful ski video I've ever seen, hands down. Yeah.
Oh, that's some high praise right there. Damn.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's so good. Awesome. And to see it on the big screen at High Five, they have like this huge screen. It's also, you know, the perfect way to experience something like that.
Oh
yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Well, that's most of the questions I got. Is there anything that we haven't talked about yet that you guys want to touch on?
Well, when is the so he made this like 10-minute behind the scenes video from Japan.
Ooh, yeah.
Which I've only seen once. And see, the thing about Japan is when you spend a month there, you're going to have a lot of different experiences that can't be fully covered in the movie. And we certainly did have a lot of experiences that we haven't even, and stories that we haven't even begin to unfold. But I think that you did a good job documenting the behind the scenes there. I was just wondering if that was ever going to drop at some point, because I want to see it again.
Yeah, that's in the plans. It should probably drop in like 2 weeks maybe.
Nice, looking forward to it.
I just filmed, like, took every chance I got to just take out the iPhone and film like all the crazy shit that went down. And there's this, I just want to mention one story that's
please
pretty crazy, because we were staying down in Asahikawa up in Hokkaido. It's actually like a pretty large town, and we stayed at this hotel, and you know, conversations can be a little hard to do in Japan when no one speaks English. And we're checking into the hotel, it's super messy, blah blah blah, bags everywhere, car, and I was driving, so I was gonna go park the car.
Mm.
And it's just like a garage with the space of one car. Okay, it's like, okay, is this the garage for the whole hotel? and then the door pops open, and it's sort of the thing, you know, when you go to the mechanic and you like drive the car up, so it's like
onto a lift.
Yeah, exactly, onto a lift. And then I go out of the car, and I look up, and there's just like cars stacked on top of each other.
What?
in like full Matrix mode. And then there's like this little window, so when you go out, you can see the car like it turning 90 degrees and then just like zoop, goes up. And it's like this, I don't even know. Can you describe it, Phil? Like,
no, it's, yeah, Matrix for sure. It's like this car, like sleeping car graveyard or something. But it's like those in Tokyo, they have the little like cubicles for rent for sleeping for people like that. But they do it for cars too. It's creepy.
Yeah, it's, and really, it's like 10 stories of cars. You just look up and you just, and it's like dark up there. So you just like, it looks like the cars are going like,
it's a vending machine. It looks like a vending machine for cars, which it kind of is. Because then you like get your car back in the morning and it's like beep, like A1. And then it's like selects your car and brings it down this lift, which is, I think, an apt analogy because there's the whole, all of Japan runs off of vending machines. You can get anything from a vending machine. They're everywhere, including the most rural places.
Yeah, you drive on like, you drive on the road up north, and it's just like, in the middle of the road, there's just like this vending machine.
Yes, you've been,
you haven't seen a house for like an hour. It's like, oh, there's a vending machine. Oh, it probably sells like coffee and cigarettes.
Yeah. He also documents the deepest day ever, which was pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, the behind the scenes from the deepest day ever.
Is there anything good from filming with Parker that we haven't discussed with him yet? Shit from behind the scenes from hanging out with him, I'm asking, not like filming, but
you probably noticed the dynamic between Parker and Frito. It's like just in a full rant comedy show, it's awesome. And Parker is just a hilarious guy. So, yeah, there's some pretty funny clips in there of the boys.
We got haircuts, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else? Friedel, you got anything? Other questions you want
to ask? I have one more thing. It doesn't pertain to Lucas as much, but... But at some point over the summer, some kids on New Schoolers had noticed that the real-time
Yo,
DVD,
oh my god, dude, I can't believe I forgot to ask you guys about this. The expiration date.
What?
Yeah,
what?
So if you bought the real-time DVD, which came out in the fall of 2007,
I
did all the graphic design for this movie. So I like to like put in little Easter eggs throughout the cover and all that.
Yep.
And on the DVD and on the DVD box, it's basically an expiration date, but it's on the DVD, which I'm holding in my hand right now, it says best of you before November 31st, 2019, which is certainly a premonition, if nothing else.
What? how did you get, did you write that?
I did. I totally wrote that as just a funny joke, and it's not intentional.
are you part of the Illuminati?
Yeah. It's like what's that movie with Tom Hanks? The book, The Da Vinci Code. It's like a little Da Vinci Code. it's not a Da Vinci Code situation here. But I'll leave that up to interpretation what that means, but it's very it has some pretty amazing foresight, intentional or not. But I think in 2007 2019 seemed pretty far away. TBQH. the other thing about that though is that there is no November 31st. There's only 30 days in November, so...
Damn, super
do
spooky.
With that information what you will. But okay. this kid that brought this to our attention is like, is this intentional or is this just coincidence? And I was like, holy shit, mind blown. Because I wrote that on that graphic. So anyway, I wanted to address that.
Dope. Yeah, I'm glad you did.
That's a good way to end the podcast. Holy.
Hell yeah. Lucas, thank you for taking the time to do this, dude. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, boys.
Yeah, thanks, mm-hmm. man.
And Friedel, of course, you too. Thanks for sending it up, dude.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Connor. I guess we'll see you next time.
Yeah, see you in Japan.
All right, popping our 20th and final weekly episode. How are we doing, guys?
The time has flown by.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When did we start this? June of 2009?
How many hundred hours of talking ago is the question?
Yeah.
Too many.
It's going
to be like almost 50 hours of audio.
Yeah, there it is. 50-hour oral history of level one.
Yeah, it's the more or less unabridged oral history. Kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Did we talk about how this whole thing started in the podcast? Did that ever come up?
It started being level one?
How the podcast started, because that's something that people have asked me about a whole bunch of times.
No,
and
I don't know if we
ever actually talked about the podcast on the podcast.
No.
Inception moment.
Okay.
So I will take that one. Connor came in starting, what was the date, like June 10th or something like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Second week in June. And young buck intern, age 23 mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And your history of level one movies had gone back. How many years did you...
It went back about 3.5 weeks prior to my arrival date when Stefan told me that I would interview for this job. And I said, okay, well, it's time to buy Zigzag like I've been meaning to for a while and watch a level one movie, because none of them were on the internet available for you to watch. You know, because you guys wanted to have people pay for them, because that's the model.
Yep.
So, yeah, I had not seen shit, just know that level one was where it was at, and was like, yep, this job, line me up, okay. And got here and was like, well, now I need to watch every movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So Connor was living in a school bus parked on the street outside the level one office. And
Still is.
Way more appealing, I'd like to say, hanging out in the office tonight than on the bus. And so that led to you hanging out, watching movies on a nightly basis. And I'd come in ahead of everybody else in the mornings, and Connor would inevitably be making coffee and start asking me questions about some of the movies. Like, oh, man, like, what happened with this? And how did that work out? And I started telling these borderline ridiculous stories, and your response is, dude, we got to record this shit. Like, this is gold. Like, this is stuff that other people need to hear. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, maybe this fall, like when we're done editing, like when we got time. And I remember I probably called you about it, Friedel, and like bounced it off of you.
No, it was when I showed up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because you were coming in right then anyway.
Yeah. Okay. But I think I mentioned it maybe to Chewy first. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes, correct. But Chewy was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. Let's do 20-minute episodes.
Yeah. That was the feedback. He's like, yeah, that's great, but we got to keep this real short and tight. Like, aim for 20 minutes. And it's like,
really covering a lot there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the movie's called High Five.
And that's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, I guess it was when you showed up, Friedel, bouncing idea off of you, and you're like, yeah, let's record the first one tomorrow and put it out on Sunday and do this on a weekly basis starting now. And it was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, like we can handle that. And not realizing at the time we bit off way more than we could chew.
Even no, we chewed it.
We did. We did chew it. But man,
we
like
underestimated the mouthful.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I kind of assume that these things might be, you know, bordering on an hour at times. And the first few, which was just you and I, and I think that was a little more of a simple process. Mm-hmm. But the goal, I think, was not to cut any of these stories short and to really let things breathe. And then to introduce some other people, bring in some athletes and filmers and part of our crew as guests. And I think that added a lot of flavor and a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Well, stoked that you guys were like, yeah, let's get it. Because it's been fun as shit, and Thank you to everyone who has tuned in and listened to this, because it's been awesome hearing how many people enjoy hearing the shit behind the scenes, and I know you guys feel the same way.
Stay tuned for Level 21 podcast dropping.
Which is a podcast about the 20-episode podcast.
Yeah.
So we're going to be revisiting each episode, talking about the recording process.
What we did right, what we could have tweaked.
How many beers were drank by who, and how we, like, figured out the live feeds with FaceTime, and it's really compelling. Yeah. Stories that you got to hear.
Gripping stuff. All right, we're going to do a mailbag here for a little while. We had some questions that have been sitting in the inbox for a little while that we haven't gotten to, and some that just came in recently, but, like, a lot of fucking people asked some variation on the question, which we discussed in the first episode, but we should, might as well run it back here. What is next? Where is Level 1 dead? Will there ever be another movie? What is going to happen this season? Like, what's going on, guys?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I want to put out there is that Level 1 is not going anywhere. We're not going out of business. We're not moving out of the office. We're not, shutting down operation in any way. I think this was really just an opportunity for us to press the reset button. I think, you know, I brought it up on several occasions throughout this podcast that I think it's important for us both creatively, for one, because to repeat the same process for 20 years in a row, it's been a challenge to come up with a you know, unique delivery system, if you will, for what is in a lot of ways the same content, just, you know, different people, different locations, different light, different snow conditions. And so, I think that is really, like, number one, is just to be able to mix things up and pursue other opportunities, other projects. As I've also mentioned before, that one thing that I think has differentiated Level 1 from a lot of the other production companies out there is that the original group that started it, well, which was, I guess, me, and then certainly Friedel, like, this is what we do. Like, I certainly never got to a point where I was willing to pass the reins on to somebody else and just be like, all right, guys, like, make this movie. I'll see you at the premiere. And I feel like that's what happened with a number of other production companies, because the people that get the ball rolling in the first place, they also come to a point in their lives where they want to do things differently. But for me, it was never really an option to walk away from it and to really, you know, let somebody else take the reins in their entirety and take it in a different direction. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we've been able to stick around and stay somewhat successful, is the fact that we are the same core group of people making these films. And that was really important to me, because I've seen some of these other longstanding production companies, even outside of skiing, it's just the movies they're making today might not bear any resemblance to what they did 2 years ago or five years ago or 10 years ago. And I just couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's better to burn out than fade away, as I think Neil Armstrong once said. You know, the first guy on the moon. As Josh said, it also has defined our lives for the last 20 years. Like, so to the point where it's, like, so baked in, you're on, like, this annual schedule, and every month has a different, like, indicator to it, or, like, process, if you will. So it's a,
you call it a hamster wheel before.
Very much so.
I mean, it's a hamster wheel, and that has negative connotations, I think, more than anything else, because that's just a way to ease boredom for a hamster in a cage. But
we're doing a little more than easing boredom.
It is like this thing that you're just constantly doing, and you get good at doing. And I think that's really hard to, like, stop that once you're in that hamster wheel, is to because you get good at something and it's hard to leave.
Well, like, even just, like, on that specific note, Friedel, I mean, that's one of the things I mentioned, how we got from Strike 3 to Forward, is because Strike 3, I was finishing up editing in the fall, and all of a sudden it started to snow, and it was just like, well, this is what I do. Okay. You know, let's go shoot more skiing.
Yeah.
I never even had a break of any kind to think about what would come next, because I never even allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that continued for 20 years straight. And granted, we got to a point in time where it was a lot more purposeful, and we had a more of a goal in mind than, oh, like panic mode, it's snowing, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, to some extent, it's the same way. And it's actually kind of funny. Today in particular, I've thought about this a lot because, what is it, today, the 28th of October? Yeah. Today is October 28th. We have, I'd say maybe 3-4 inches of snow on the ground in Denver. Mm-hmm. And if we were making an annual film, I would be strongly considering making phone calls right now and bringing a crew.
You would have been making phone calls last week. Okay, when you saw the
probably true.
Yeah, probably true.
It was a huge deja vu moment to the Halloween storm of 2009, exactly 10 years ago, where we shot those clips of the Met, which we discussed in the iTrip episode. But yeah. But I mean, back to that like annual thing, I definitely never wanted to be making movies just for the sake of making movies, just because that's what you're locked into. And I've seen other people do that as well. And it's like, I remember hearing this interview with like the guys, this creators of South Park. And, you know, when they, that's like a thing that's been going on for over 20 years now. And they just keep churning it out. And I think they still have passion for it. But when like, the Dave Chappelle show thing was such a flashbang, and then it was gone. It was that it was done. He didn't milk it out. And like Trey Parker, Matt Stone was like quitting's for quitters. Like if you're good at something, just keep doing it, which is one way to do that for sure. But nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
And that's something I didn't want to, just keep on doing just because like that's what you're now known for and good at. So you have to break that cycle. Nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
Luke O'Brien wants to know if Super Unknown is done.
No, Super Unknown is most definitely not done. In fact, that's something I think we also have touched on in another podcast to some extent, is that is one of the things that I'm really excited to continue and even to grow, because in the context of what I do on a day-to-day basis throughout the winter, I felt like I had to hold back as far as not being able to put as much time and resources into Super Unknown as I think I'll be able to now.
Dope.
And that's something I'm really excited about and still figuring out, you know, what those changes are really going to look like. But I think a video talent search contest continues to have a place, regardless of the fact that we can't necessarily offer this appearance in next year's movie, which I think was definitely a carrot dangling from a stick for a lot of people. But I still think that we can come up with a lot of things that'll continue to make people excited to be part of it. And it's still a very cool thing. And I think the reach is only growing.
TBF11 wants to know if you guys would ever consider making surf videos, going poor boys on them.
Yeah, pow surf videos.
Word. Neither of you guys are surfers by nature. Well, maybe by nature a little bit, but you don't surf as far as I know.
I would love to. I've probably been like a half dozen times in my life, and it's something that I would love to do.
I've been paddling before, not really surfing. Did some paddling, though.
I stood up.
There you go.
but no, it's the reason we make ski videos, and that's another question that I've been asked over the years, like, oh, like, do you guys make ski videos or do you also make snowboard videos? It's like, well, no, we make ski videos, and I think we make them well in large part due to the fact that that's where our roots are. That's where we come from. We were all skiers at some point in our lives, and still are to some extent, and that's one of the things that, for one, drives the passion, and for two, allows us to look through the lens of the athletes and know what's cool and how to capture something and how to, you know, share it with people because of our experience participating in it. And that's not to say that I don't think I could shoot surfing very well or make a cool surf video, but that's not where our connections are. But all that said, I bumped into Johnny DeCesare, who is the man who is, you know, really, that's exactly what he did. He made ski videos for a number of years, borderline. Well, I don't think he really did for 2 decades, but Poor Boy certainly did. And now that's all Johnny does. And I've been meaning to follow up with an email and be like, hey, Johnny, can I come on a shoot? I'll carry your camera back for you.
Well, that was always a joke, too, because it's like, oh, man, surf filmers have it made because they're literally on the beach or in like a boat in Tahiti or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, North Shore, Hawaii. And there's like chicks walking around in bikinis and like just everything you can imagine. And
just
then
bring your sunscreen and your boonie
hat. Complete polar opposite of the very unglamorous life of a ski cinematographer. But to answer his question, surfing is well documented, and there's plenty of good people doing that. I don't think I personally have anything to offer that can beat those guys.
No. And to be clear, I don't think I have anything to offer that's going to trump what's going on there. I don't have any vision or ability that, but that said, I'd love to get on a surf shoot.
Word.
That would be a lot of fun.
Related. Yeah. Will Loom wants to know, are any of you both skiers and boarders?
Never done it in my entire life.
What does he mean by that? absolutely.
I snowboarded when I was like 8 years old in a Burton Free 3. It was like 1986, 1987, something like that. And got one for Christmas one year in Southern Vermont. And I just didn't have the patience to learn. So I would bring my skis and my snowboard and my ski boots and my snowboard boots to the mountain every day. I think it was going to Magic Mountain in Southern Vermont at that point. And I'd take like 2 to 3 runs on the bunny hill, and I'd have like kids like mouthing off and like throwing snowballs and shit like that. And just, fuck you. And I'd go get my skis and like do spread eagles over them.
Really? You've dabbled on the one plank.
I love snowboarding. Yeah, I go both ways for sure.
Hey.
Yeah, I still do a bunch. And now, you know, we add in the quiver these no boards, aka pow surfers. Yeah. So I'm probably, Montana just got a bunch of snow. I'm definitely going to be doing it this week when I get back up there. But that's,
bastard.
Yeah, I try to ski / snowboard / pow surf as much as humanly possible over the course of a season. I think that's something that certainly like keeps the passion alive. There's no question about it. And that's like why, what I signed up for, like why I want to be in the mountains. I love filming. I love documenting, but if I'm not engaging it on some level, I'm only looking at it through a viewfinder. It's like a real good way to get burnt out on it. So, and everyone that I work with and travel with these days is very pro, free shred / very inclined to have me participate and join in. So I very much appreciate that. Dope. Obviously there's days when you can't, you gotta bust ass and film and get it done, but I have maybe even in the last few years like spent more and more time on a ski and snowboard than I had in before. So, but yeah, if you're in a place like Japan and you're not engaging in some of that, like, yeah, that's,
fuck that noise.
Yeah, you miss me with that.
Wear it out.
I took 4 runs this year.
That's pretty brutal, Berman.
Yeah, that's brutal, man. You got to fix that.
No. I know. Yeah. No.
I probably got like 40 days in or something.
Oh,
I mean, that's not full days. That's sure, like a run in between filming or whatever. But
no, that's something that I did not do enough of over the years, because I always had this motto that if it was good enough for me to want to ski, it was good enough for me to need to shoot. And I definitely shortchanged myself on a number of situations.
The where dead end just, street, dude.
It's going to kill you if you do that.
I know. But I somehow made it through, and I still got the love.
No,
but
there's a good way to strike a balance.
Well,
the grind
and I mean,
stuff.
It certainly explains your success to some degree, that level of motivation contributes to why we're sitting where we are right now.
Probably true, but Friedel's right. Like, you definitely have to have that balance. And it's funny because I remember Decker back in the day got to the point where he'd go off and just be like, I fucking hate skiing. I fucking hate it. Just like, really? It was just like so over it. And he was definitely not taking free laps at any point. Granted, he was primarily the urban filmer for a number of years. I don't think he did too much backcountry, but, or not enough. But, but yeah, I think that was a big part of it, is you just get it in your head. Like, he was also such a fucking hard worker. I mean, dude, you know, goes like the Energizer Bunny and like, you know, similar to me, just doesn't know when to like stop working. And that can be overwhelming at times. And you lose
touch with what you're like documenting in a lot of ways, because you just become this like
documenter and that's it.
Agent. Yeah. It's like robotic. Like, you're just this person. You got to sample the product. You got to get involved.
Grade A.
Yeah.
James Sawyer Kelly wants to know if you guys miss shooting on mini DV handycams.
No.
Yes.
Oh. Mini DV is like such a horrible format. You have to log those things.
Yeah.
And no, I love handycams. Like this,
that's what I'm answering.
We discussed. Sure. I have the current version of a handycam, which is like the Sony handycam.
Yeah,
which is a 4K. It takes an SD card. You can just pop that thing out, plug it in.
Yeah,
dump some shots. Gain like that. End of story. Mm. No, like and yeah, I think we were talking about our love for the Sony VX2000 back in the day, or back in these episodes. But right. And back in the day is when we used them. But no, mini DV is garbage. Like it's like now you gotta, yeah. As we discussed, I think a bunch there. It's like a sensitive little ribbon of tape running over wheels, and you gotta manually hit in and out points to log those shots onto a computer.
Yeah. Yeah, tape I don't miss at all. But as far as like the handycam concept,
because you guys both shoot a lot of handheld still these days, but the cameras you're using are a lot heavier than those VXs were.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, Friedel picked up, like you said, you know, the modern version of a handycam shoots 4K, but right. It's you know rockered zoom lens and like all the things that we've come to know and love from handycams back in the day. Mm. I, however, don't do that, and I'm just running handheld on a Red. Which I've come to love, but it's an entirely different thing than the handycam, and it forces you to shoot in a different way. You're shooting different content. You're getting different reactions from people.
Yeah,
and it's very different. And man, I fucking wish that you could like put that Red sensor and a rockered zoom lens in a little handycam format. You could walk around and get like beautiful, you know, 5K imagery on a handy cam, because that would just be the best of both worlds. Because
it truly would be. I mean, my hard no on that question was only simply referring to why he included the mini DV tape.
Sure,
because
sure,
I
sure.
am a video camera filmer, like at heart. That's how I learned how to film. I never, you know, I filmed years and years and years and a lot of level on movies on a camera with no interchangeable lens.
Yeah,
and like a wide angle lens that you'd screw on top, and rockered zoom, which I still miss and still love so much.
I love
it.
It
was a hard transition going from like to an interchangeable lens system, and I honestly didn't see the benefit at first. I was like, oh, this just means more surfaces,
more weight,
yeah, more surfaces to get like scratched or like dust on. Slower. I hate being slow. Like video cameras, like in that handy cam, you can just whip out and you're catching off the cuff stuff fast. And in general, you're just going to be a faster moving filmer. So no one's waiting around for you. Mm. But yeah, amen. Video cameras are great.
I tried at one point, Tommy Joyce suggested this neck strap contraption that I could put around my Red. So for a little while, I was trying to like dangle a Red from my neck the way you would a dad cam.
Spine.
It's like 12 pounds of like sharp ass metal banging around on your sternum.
Will Whittleton wants to know what movie had the best soundtrack. It's kind of a tough one, but it's a good
second generation.
It's not. Sonny's up there for sure. Mm. I think Sonny had like a really well-rounded soundtrack that I still enjoy today, and a lot of that music matched the skiing. If I had to pick one, I think it would be Sonny. But I like some Tracks in Pleasure, maybe not the entire soundtrack as a whole. Yeah, as a soundtrack as a whole, Sonny. Yeah.
Weird. What about you, Josh?
Ah, man, I would have to really like dig in before giving a definitive answer, but I think Friedel brings up a very good point. Like Sonny had a just really nice, well-rounded but cohesive soundtrack. It all kind of fit together. I think every year after the movie's out, there are always a few songs that I like better than others, and it's just that's the reality of it.
Yeah. Alex Merriweather wants to know, which, with all these crazy places that you guys have gone, India, Japan, Iceland, Scandinavia, is there a big one on the list that you haven't made it to yet? To shoot skiing specifically, let's say.
Yeah, the moon comes to mind. The dark side.
Personally, or just as far as like level one goes?
I think that's a personal question. Yeah. Like I would love if level one went there. I don't want to go there. level one should definitely do a trip to Kazakhstan, but it ain't gonna be me. Yeah. I mean, Japan was that one white whale for me because right. I had never been through all these years, and I finally crossed that off my list last year to a big, you know, I live up to every expectation I had.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, now I'm out. Did it. No, that was the one outstanding where it's like such an iconic skiing and ski film destination that I had never set foot in.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a hard question to answer, though. I'm trying to think of an actual destination I haven't been to that I'd like to visit. I feel like I would have been there at this point.
I've never heard you guys talk about going to Australia, New Zealand.
Okay, that's the answer.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I knew there was something. So that is the bucket list destination is in New Zealand. It's certainly not Australia.
Yeah.
I have no interest in skiing there.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen what it looks like. It looks okay. They have nice parks. No, New Zealand is the answer to that. And it's always conflicted. You know, the best time of year to be there is August and September.
Yeah.
That doesn't jibe well with making and editing a ski movie. So it was never even close to being in the cards.
Right.
And it's also very expensive. It's hit or miss with conditions for sure. And, you know, just a massive travel initiative to get down there. But
yeah,
I would like to go. I would love to ski New Zealand. It's probably it appears to be one of these postcard beautiful places on Earth, and with good mountains and probably some good fishing and stuff as well. Or there is. I know that for a fact. Mm. That's another reason I want to go there.
Okay.
So I got to pick the season, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just move there for a year.
New Zealand, I'm coming for you one time, man.
Anything for you, Josh?
Yeah, slightly less exotic, but I never got to go on my Russia trip.
Right.
Or at least I still have not gone on my Russia trip that I've wanted really badly to go on. And again,
that was going
to
be like Russia for POW and backcountry stuff, right?
Yes.
Not like Moscow
the
Street.
The Caucasus or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Like And yeah, I mean, that just fell apart when the conditions went south and it started raining to the top of the peaks. And yeah, that'll force a change in the old plans. And yeah, and then I wanted to, after that, we started talking about going for a street trip. But at that point, Decker was like, oh, I want to go to Russia. It's like, all right, cool. You can go to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just never made sense for me after that, because again, I'm evaluating a lot of these trips in the context of, you know, what can I stack a crew with as far as athletes and filmers? And then where are the holes that I need to fill?
Yeah.
And it was always like, yeah, well, we've got Danny on the ground in Moscow, who's like, you know, our fixer, filmer, everything, who could probably just do the trip all by himself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it was just really easy to have Danny, you know, run these things.
Mm.
And then, you know, the year for Habit that we just talked about, that was a big one. And we wanted to put a second filmer on that. And it made sense to send Robin just because he was available. It was a little bit less travel for him and more cost effective. And it's like, all right, I'm still not going to Russia, but one day.
Word. Good shit. Alex also says, I had Casey Dean as a ski coach for a camp in Chile a long time ago. Does he still spend a crazy amount of time getting his hair perfect?
Oh, yeah.
Of course,
sure.
He does. Yeah.
Word.
Yeah.
Hard yes.
Glad we could confirm that for you, Alex. Colin Malone says, at the IF3 Montreal premiere of Small World, there was a guy who said he was the sound mixer who spent the afternoon at the premiere and the entire night at the after party without a shoe because he claimed he lost it at the theater hammered. Was he actually the sound guy, and did he ever find the shoe?
No, he was not the sound guy. Yes, he was with level one, and that's Stefan Tchaikovsky.
What? Sorry, what?
Stefan got hammered and like somehow got so drunk
Small
that his shoe fell off.
Oh, at I-3.
And he just ran around Montreal for the rest of the night with one shoe.
He may have been dabbling in sound.
Yeah, that was the year he started to get into it with Whistler Say.
Oh, I thought you meant like the sound guy. Like,
no, not the sound guy at the venue. Like, yeah.
Sounds like breaking into the sound booth.
No, the level one sound.
That might have gotten lost in translation.
Gotcha. Yes. Yeah, Stefan started to do a little bit of sound stuff for us that year.
Yeah. Did he ever find the shoe?
No.
Mm-mm. Rest in peace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Question is, did he fly back with one shoe or did he actually go buy another pair of shoes?
I don't know. Yeah. We're going to have to go follow up on that.
How do you lose a shoe? Honestly.
If you remembered, it wouldn't be that big a deal.
Right.
Garrett Priest. Listen to us talking about Dave Lesh in the Real Time podcast. He wants to know if there's any more deets regarding Dave Lesh's first and last appearance in a Level 1 movie. Seems like it's probably a juicy story.
Do we want to get into that? Ultimately, he just did not fit on our program. He came on board as a photographer and created some opportunities for him to tag along on some shoots, but he was never a Level 1 athlete, despite claims to the contrary, and there was never really a strong consideration to work with him.
Mort.
That was a big and.
That was a big and. Yeah. And to dispel rumors and statements that he has made that are completely untrue, there was never a situation where he was either cut from a movie or from an opportunity because sponsors wouldn't pay for him. Mm. So, sorry, Lesh. Ain't true.
Word. Swerve Everything, that's an Instagram handle, wants to know how to deal with icy/cold camera gear. Any pro tips for like shooting in the winter, shooting ski stuff? I don't know.
I got some. Yeah. I got some. I have spent all the money you can spend on fancy camera covers and protectors and you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And I take my very fancy red kit and I have a custom made trash bag that I cut up and use gaff tape to build my own camera cover because it's better than any of the super fancy canvas ones.
Yeah, trash bags work so well.
Yeah.
I actually freak out if I don't have a trash bag in any sort of sensitive conditions. Because they're like really easy to get on and off too.
Yeah.
And it can like, yeah, as Josh said, you can like fully just form it around your camera. But batteries, cameras usually work fine in the cold or any like camera I have worked with, it's batteries that don't. And you have to, if it's really cold, I'll put those in an inner liner of my jacket to keep them warm. So those things don't just brick out. But if you do get ice and snow on your camera, because it definitely happens if you're filming in extremely variable winter conditions, like I try to like a hack I figured out or whatever, it was like a mini ShamWow type towel. It's like super absorbent towels. I carry one in my jacket, like in my jacket pocket, my breast pocket. And anytime it gets, I can wipe down the camera at any point because those things, they can take a lot of shit and abuse, but at a certain point, they're just a shell covering a computer. So like you do need to like water is bad. Condensation.
Yeah.
Condensation bad. So this little mini ShamWow does magic. You can just always keep it dry that way.
Here's another thing is that after however much time you spend outdoors shooting in the field, your camera itself is going to freeze. It's just going to get really cold. And these things can operate in sub-zero conditions. And I've definitely seen that get so cold to the point where your LCD screen
starts
like slurring. I mean, basically looks like the screen is drunk. Everything's like kind of ghosting the screen because those little liquid crystals in your liquid crystal display are freezing and slowing down, which is kind of nuts. But so your camera gets so cold that you have to be very careful once you bring it back into a warm environment. And a very easy mistake to make is to just take it right out in your really warm hotel room or lodge or, you know, where, or your car, wherever, and try to just let it dry off, and you'll see, I mean, it becomes covered with condensation immediately. The problem is that all that condensation that you see on the outside of your camera is also happening on the inside of your camera. Mm. So one thing that I was taught actually by Chris O'Connell, photographer, way back in the day, is to just leave your camera in the camera pack all sealed up for as many hours as you reasonably can. And like sometimes I'll have to go in, you know, like grab your batteries or something like that.
Yeah, sometimes you can't always do it, but
well, it's not, it's like this breaking the seal thing where all of a sudden, oh my God, I let the hot air in. But there's a difference between keeping it in that camera pack and letting it acclimate.
Oh yeah.
And just getting your memory cards out, getting your batteries out, whatever you need, and then closing it back up versus like putting your camera out in front of the fireplace to warm up.
Yeah. It's gnarly.
Which is an intuitive, maybe not in front of the fireplace, but like you would think that letting it warm up is a smart thing. So, yeah.
Just slowly. Yeah. It's all about time. Slowly. That.
Yeah.
You do want it to warm up and dry
it's
out
like
eventually.
Deep sea diving.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to get the bends.
Don't give your camera the bends.
Yeah.
Right.
Connor has a sheet of mini Instagram screenshots printed
out.
I'm trying
to read your handles.
And he's reading
like
a thumbnail.
Size like 4 font. Andre, no, I don't know. I can't read this handle, but someone wants to know.
Someone.
What's your favorite segment in the history of Level 1 ever? Favorite seg.
Ooh.
That is a
great question. Thought provoking.
I don't pick favorites, Andre, but it's Parker White and Sonny and Phil Casbon and Refresh.
That took all of 3.1 seconds.
Josh?
Dude, those are really good ones. I think Crichton's forward part stands out. That's like a top fiver.
The top five is way easier than doing a top.
Yeah, your favorite ever.
Top three.
I mean, Friedel just gave two that I agree with, and I threw Crichton in there. I'd put Ahmet's eye trip part in there potentially. Eye trips on Valley part. I mean, that was a standout. There are five of them.
There you go.
I could add another five and just replace all of them pretty easily, I'm sure. But those are definitely some standout moments for sure.
Word. I would go with Emil Cody in High Five.
Word.
Hell yeah.
That
Numa.
Or LSM this year. But
yeah.
My
yeah. Okay. Okay. See, I liked. It's hard going new for me because I think things need to be filtered
by time. Marinate.
Right.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Word. I appreciate those.
Someone wants to know, why is it so difficult to make money in the ski industry? Advice to kids who want to try.
Don't do it. That's a good question.
I think the first part is maybe the more interesting part, or at least more. Well, this is very different questions.
Sure. And there's also no quick, there's not like an easy, like a short answer. Money trees don't grow outside.
Yeah.
For one. In the winter. Yeah.
Incubator for that shit.
Like a sunroom is really nice.
Yeah. Greenhouse. I don't know. I'd be curious to get everybody else's take on this. Obviously,
this is an often discussed thing within skiing.
Sure.
Ski industry.
Absolutely. Sure. Like, how do you crack the code? But at this point, there is no real code because I don't think it's a very healthy industry. Now that's the biggest part of the problem.
Healthy also, like it's detrimental to your health or like it's dying?
No, I'm not
economically
say
healthy.
Economically healthy.
Mm.
It's just there's a lot. I mean, it's this like very, I don't know, glamorous from the outside perspective thing. Skiing is like champagne and caviar and aspen and powder and, you know, European vacations.
Yeah.
Just like, oh man, skiing is like this.
That should be a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Champagne and caviar and aspen and European vacations.
And powder.
Do it up, Chewy.
Yeah. But I mean, there's this like perspective, this fallacy of skiing being a wealthy sport. And it's more of.
Well, that's not a fallacy for the
participants.
The participants are wealthy for sure, but that does not necessarily mean that there's a ton of money going around, because let's be honest, there's a lot of expense that's incurred by resorts in running their operations, in brands, in developing and building a product, mm-hmm. whether it's outerwear, soft goods, or whatever. The margins are pretty slim and the participation base is not huge. And you're also trying to sell a product to people that they're not going to buy every year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing that the core demo might be beating the shit out of their skis and they want like the fresh new pro model that's coming out because it's cool. But that demographic makes up such a small percentage of the overall marketplace that like, I don't know, your average, if you will, skiing participant buys new gear once every 5 to 10 years or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's a very slow refresh rate, and there's just like not a lot of money like flowing around in excess that's going to contribute to, big budget film projects and paying athletes tons of money. And, you know, there's a very, very short run of a golden era that we've discussed that, came and went before Level One really hit its stride, mm-hmm. where I think that there was a lot of money being paid out to athletes and ski media and, almost like this experimental, like, you know, riding the wave, the high tide, like, oh, is this going to keep going? And it didn't. Mm. And I think part of the problem too is that, you know, as these brands have become more global and, you know, the industry as a whole becomes more global, you know, we're so reliant on conditions. It's a seasonal sport and it's very difficult, if not impossible, to have a situation where it's like, yeah, like, 2019 was a great year for skiing globally. It's like, well no, like North America might have been good, but Europe sucked or vice versa.
It's not in North America as a whole. It's parts of North America.
Right. For sure. But it's just like, there's so many different factors. But that's right. It's like, oh, California represents, you know, 36% of like ski sales in North America. I'm just mm-hmm. making up numbers here. But let's imagine like California has another drought. And it's like, well, that just like fucks everything up for the U.S. And that means everything's fucked for North America.
Kind of a domino effect there with like how sales work. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're also just looking at a sport that is based on a niche within a population center that's only living at certain latitudes, right? Mm. And like everyone else in the world can't really relate to it. If you are born and raised in Florida or wherever else that's even remotely equatorial, you really don't, I don't think, really are not going to relate to moving on snow as a activity. In the same way that, yeah, I like, am not a surfer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I didn't grow up on the ocean or whatever. It's always, people always try to make comparisons within like an action sports category to skateboarding, and skateboarding is going to just always have more universal appeal for that reason, because it doesn't need cold, like hilly conditions.
Yeah. You can skateboard anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But then if I'm going to press on this a little bit more, yeah. I would say that snowboarding has a very different structure. The money moves differently in snowboarding, I will say. Like some of the bigger brands, there's a like more attention towards core parts of the sport than I think we see in skiing, where no one's doing what Level One does really anymore and making street movies with a high production value, because that's not what brands want. Why does snowboarding get to be different?
My theory there is that it is based more on image and association with image. So snowboarding being a board sport, always has had like a cool factor to it, and like a cool youth factor or whatever. So when people started, like money started flowing into snowboarding from the outside, not just from mom and pop like board brands or whatever, mm-hmm. then they were giving money that they're not necessarily going to see back in product sales like directly, but it's more just being associated with something cool and that image of what snowboarding represents. So you have like more outside money basically to go around because of that. And skiing has never been the full-on beneficiary of that kind of thing.
I also have that it factor.
It just, yeah. And it things reversed a little bit there. I think that skiing has had its moment again, mm-hmm. like it did maybe in the whatever hot dog heyday or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's, you know, since snowboarding became the behemoth that it is, and probably somebody could point to like peak snowboarding being near 2000 or something like that.
Late '90s for sure.
Late '90s. Mm. It's always been like a battle, not a battle, but just like for attention with snowboarding. And they are always going to have, yeah, people that, because it's a board sport, will favor that image more so than skiing, and the money follows that. I also think that snowboarding is not doing as hot as everyone thinks it is.
Hmm.
Like, there's not, the money is being probably appropriated in places that we desire a little more.
Mm-hmm.
The money that exists, but right. There's still not like endless amounts of it the way that there was a lot of money in snowboarding in the 90s. And like you hear about people getting $500,000 royalty checks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And like budgets, that Red Bull was dishing out that were essentially blank checks for Travis Rice, circa 2006 and seven or whatever.
Right.
So that's not quite flowing that same way in that, in snowboarding.
There's certainly been a downturn in snowboarding as well. I think the thing we haven't brought up here is Instagram and how that's affected both of these industries, but social media as a whole too. But
right.
One thing that I want to point out really quick, just on this topic, is that snowboarding as a sport has always had a much more streamlined image, just based on when it came about and the people that it was appealing to. And budgets have always been directed for the most part to promote that specific image and sell product to that, you know, demographic, if you will. And I'll point out, to the contrary, a lot of the brands that we work with traditionally have a marketing budget, and their global marketing budget, 80% might be pushed in the direction of supporting Alpine race in Europe.
Right.
And that's
Street skier is going to not get any of that money. And if they did, I think they would see, a lot of companies would see that as like a detriment to their sales or what they're trying to associate themselves with. Whereas in snowboarding, you sponsor a street rider, they're representing snowboarding as a whole.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of, absolutely right about that, though. It's like
there's
a
no
very
like, oh man, like, cut. Yeah, it's like, this is snowboard. It's like, well, no, this is youth skiing. This is like, you know, alpine race skiing. Yeah. These are the different demographics within the sport, and you don't have that division within snowboarding.
Yeah, skiing's extremely fragmented and has a lot of identity issues, whereas snowboarding, I think, has always had like, whatever your discipline within snowboarding, it's always been within the snowboarding identity. And skiing
Which is a huge difference.
Skiing has had a struggle with that.
Yeah.
How do we fix that?
We've been trying for 20 years, man. No, it's come a long way. It's being fixed. It's the generational shift is all it is. It takes a lot of time. It takes more heads that get it to come into places of power. Like when Josh, I remember going to pitch meetings with Josh when I first came on, pretty much, you know, over 15 years ago. And you're trying to explain.
I'd love to hear your memories of these.
I'm not going to bring up perfect examples of it, but like, you're trying to explain what you're doing to people and ask for money. And you have a 60 year old man that came up in racing.
Yeah.
Looking at you like you're speaking alien.
Yeah.
And
you're going to do what now?
Yeah. And it took,
you're going to go to Finland.
Yeah. This is before like, it's just like, why does this help anything? Like, and they didn't get that this was like a youth movement, and they didn't put any value on it. It took people like, we talked about Mike, Nick, and Habit. Mm-hmm. It took people like him to come into places of power and kind of fight the good fight with budgets and all that, because he got it. You know, his whole motto, was like when he started Cyber Cartel, it's like, man, if we're not offering products and like stuff like marketing that's focused towards growing this and skiing, like these same kids are just going to go to a skate shop and buy like the Burton thing instead.
That's what people were doing
straight up. That's what Wallace just ran a Ronin jacket in his Super Unknown. So it's like, if you wanted to be cool in skiing, since no one was catering to it for a long ass time, people would just go to a snowboard shop or whatever to buy their stuff. And that's all well and fine. But at a certain point, like skiing was, it was getting, eating itself or whatever instead of supporting that. And that, I have seen that come a long way. It's still a struggle, but it has changed for the better. It still doesn't mean there's a lot of money in it.
Right.
But there has, yeah, it, things have
changed. The trend is going the right way.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Word up.
It just takes time. That kind of shift does not happen overnight. That's a generational shift right there.
True that.
Is it going to happen before all the snow melts and climate change dooms the sport is the question.
It's going to coincide exactly, and we will reach peak financial success right when winter disappears forever and we're fucked.
Oh, man. Hopefully not.
Fingers crossed.
But yeah, like somebody like another example is Josh Melchick at Line. Like he came up, he's of our generation. He came up watching the same movies, doing the same thing when we were kids. And now he's in a position of controlling like the entire Line skis program.
Yeah.
So that's a huge
thing. There were little bits and pieces of that over the years. I mean, Josh Novotny was probably the earliest example of that.
And even Charlie Adams at Dinastar was like a guy in his 50s that sort of got it.
But, I mean, Charlie aside, being kind of the exception and not the rule, but I remember when Novotny was hired as the team manager for Dinastar skis, I remember thinking to myself, and probably this is around when you're referencing these early pitch meetings, and just thinking to myself, like, man, like there will come a point in time, it's somewhere down the road, where the athletes that I'm working with now and my friends now will be in the decision-making positions that these like grumpy old men are currently in that have no idea what I'm even talking about.
Right.
And that time has come, but it hasn't gotten any easier because, man, if people were working with the budgets and the cash was flowing as freely as it was now then, we'd be in a better position, but that ain't the case.
Word.
Yeah.
Good talk. Probably last listener question here. Our friend Swerve Everything sent another question. He wants to know, what is one thing that you would say advice for up and coming production companies?
Go four season multi-sport.
Film car racing. No, I think the best thing, I think we touched on it earlier, is just to be, you have to be in it for the right reasons.
Pursue your passion.
Pure passion. Mm. And that's it. Like, that's the only thing that's going to keep you alive. Because if you're analytical about it, you're going to get, quickly, dissuaded, I guess. Hmm. And it's better to be kind of naive and passionate, because that's certainly how I was. And it worked out for me. So, and it worked out for Josh, obviously. So, be naive and passionate.
Yeah.
And just do it.
Just do it.
And, hopefully your friends are good at skiing or whatever. Because that really helps too.
Yeah.
It's an awesome way to,
All the passion in the world is not going to get you anywhere if your friends suck.
Yeah. Yeah. Get better friends. If you're...
Yeah. That's the key, man. Get better friends. Or the other way around. If your friends are the best in the world and you don't have any passion, then you're going to burn out real quick and you're not going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's happened with heaps of people. We've seen a lot of people that come and go over the years. That's for sure.
Yeah. If you want to get rich and make a sound financial decision for your future, do not pursue filmmaking as an independent person.
Yeah.
That's for sure. There are definitely ways to do it. You can go to, LA, New York and get in on the ground level as a production assistant. And, I think there are definitely ways for people just to work their way up. But man, as far as like starting your own shop, it's, But that's what my boss told me back in the day. And
that's all changing too, right? Like, sure. We don't know what 10 years lies.
Yeah.
And that's where you talk about Instagram. Like, somebody that's starting a film outfit now, like, what is that? Like, how?
Well, here's the thing.
Obviously, that's a thing, but that's, like, so quickly changing. The barrier to entry
is so low. So that is the nice thing about the climate of 2019 as far as starting businesses and trying to produce media, that for, you know, a couple thousand dollars, maybe like $5,000 starting from scratch, you can get yourself a camera, a bunch of lenses, some sound equipment, memory cards, hard drives, a laptop. And you, for like $5,000, you could be a production company. And like,
well, that was true when Level One started.
Yeah, but
that hasn't changed.
Well,
it's just what you do with it, though.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, for like, you can get shit, you can get equipment to produce content that if you know what to do with, how to use it, it'll look as good as anything else that anybody's spending tens of thousands of dollars on.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Mm. Like when Level One started, yeah, like you could for a couple grand, you know, get, you know, a VX2000 and this and that, but still like it had the feel of, you know, a video camera, and you can like, the technology is so good now that, you know, you can create this illusion that you are, you know, something beyond that. So I think that there is an advantage in that for sure, but it's, and yeah, I mean, part of it is just like creativity is coming up with ways to monetize what you're doing. And there are ways. It's just not easy. It takes dedication, passion, hard work, the willingness to start.
Takes grit and tenacity.
Yeah, that's true too. And in skill. And that's the other thing, is that I think that there is, to some extent, you know, some people have it and some people don't, as far as an eye and an ability to capture content and put something together that people want to see. Yeah, you know, I've seen people with almost no training and formal education. They have that, and that's fucking awesome. And other people who've gone through all the school and, you know, parents paid for, you know, God only knows how much to get them a diploma, and they can barely figure out where the red button is to record something. And so it's a lot of factors.
Before we start talking about romance, I want to bring up Stepped. They were like the little Colorado little brother of Level One for a little while, definitely made their own name, built their own rep, established themselves as super hard, and then just got out super fast. And I think you've compared what you want to do with moving away from annual films a little bit to what Stepped has going on right now. But Stepped is like, as far as skiing goes, like, gone. I don't know, unless you watched the TGR movie this year and saw Cam and Clayton film a segment for them. But like,
well, they're producing like Henrik Harlow's project.
Yeah, they're keeping.
They have like a foot
in the waiting pool, if you will. But I mean, they've clearly got so much else going on. They're a powerhouse of a production studio right now.
Yeah,
and you know, I'd find it hard to find the time with everything that, I mean, if I had everything on my plate that those guys have on their plates, like, really hard to find the time. I mean, I haven't actually spoken to Nick much in the past couple of years, aside from just in passing saying hi, but, it sounds and looks like those users have so much going on and they're crushing it.
Mm.
But I don't think that their goal was to stay in skiing. And, you know, I think we talked about this also a little bit in one of the previous podcasts, maybe it was just an off the cuff conversation. The fact that, you know, Level One still has a brand to some extent, and, you know, we're selling t-shirts with our logo on it, and we are trying to run events like Super Unknown, and we have, you know, both ankles in that same waiting pool instead of one or a toe or whatever. And so that's going to keep us here, I think, a little longer. And I also am not moving out to LA and I'm not hiring 40 to 50 people. I don't have that interest in growing
and scaling
that way. Like, that's just not something that I want to do. So not to say that I could, if I wanted to, because, you know, hats off to those dudes. They've, you know, crack that code, if you will, mm-hmm. And are crushing it. But that's not of interest to me. I got a couple gray hairs coming in already. I don't need any more.
Word up. All right. Should we talk about the movie? Romance, number 20?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's stay.
Let's stay.
Opening seg to the movie. Tom Walsh, Phil Casbon, Mike Hornbeck, the Minnesota reunion. The kings of Twin Cities. How'd that trip come about? How'd that reunion come about? Because none of them have appeared in any of these movies for a while now, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, Walsh, Phil, Hornbeck have all been doing their own thing for years now at this point. But doing it well, mind you.
Yeah.
Still staying way, way, way in the game. And like at a high level in the game. If you look at Phil Casabon's last two winning X Games parts, for example. Yeah. But I think when we started, or I don't think, I know, when we started... basically leaking or dispersing the low-key knowledge that Level One's 20th movie would be its final, you know, chapter of an annual film, there was immediate interest in people that had worked with us in the past trying to get back in for the final thing. I mean, the first example I can think of with that is Phil Casabon. When I was at Kimbo Sessions in 2018 for filming for Zigzag, I was talking with him and I was talking with LSM and kind of letting them know about that. And they're both like, yeah, we want to get in. And Phil was like, I mean, definitely really, I think, appreciates having his roots started with Level One, and he definitely wanted a piece of it, getting back in. And then I think that quickly evolved, you know, with Kyle Decker, with Tom Walsh.
I've been in touch with Decker, and Decker was like, man, like, I got to film for some trips. And I think originally he said something maybe about getting on an urban trip and a backcountry trip. And obviously, like, you know, schedules get full and obligations take over and people have children and whatnot. Mm. And he had to scale that down a little bit, but he was very interested in building this throwback street trip. And he took the reins on that one for sure. And actually, just a little more background on Casabon and his involvement. I think initially he wanted to put a lot more into it. And I will also mention that he was looking, I think, for more of a part and less of a involvement in this throwback street part. Because I will say originally Decker's trip was supposed to have been Ahmet and Hornbeck and Walsh, which was like the original OG
Decker crew.
Exactly.
It was really right. Decker like directing his crew from the back in the day.
Phil never ran with them.
He did in small amounts. Right. Like him and Walsh, I've been on a street trip with those guys for Refresh. But no, Phil actually, his original intention was to film for Real Street again and then go on a backcountry trip or two or three. Like, he actually wanted to join up with Parker and I on something that didn't involve, like, you know, helicopters or snowmobiles or something like that. So it was a little trickier, like, finding the time for that, because originally he was going to maybe come try to join us in Japan. And then we were there all month of January, which, of course, was, like, the big bread and butter month for filming X Games. Yeah. So it just didn't happen. So ultimately it was like, all right, Phil, I know you probably don't want to do this, but it looks like the best opportunity is getting in on a street trip. Because what, Ahmet couldn't get in on that?
No, he couldn't. Well, a little bit more about that street trip is that, you know, those guys in particular had, you know, really kicked off the whole concept of these international trips. And they went to Finland for the first time. They went to Russia. There's probably one more time that they all traveled as a group overseas, and, you know, not knowing how hard anybody wanted to go, it's like, well, the easiest thing is really, you know, let them breathe as people, as personalities, because they're going to make a great part. They can do as much skiing as they want to do, whatever that means to them, and they could just have this cool part. And we're talking about going to some crazy location and just, like, as you know, you set these lofty goals, and then once reality checks start to kick in, you scale this back, you scale that back. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, Ahmet can't make it. And, Let's go to Minnesota for a week. It's like, ah.
Well, Hornbeck has a kid, so yeah, he didn't want to go that far from home.
It's like, what about Kazakhstan? It's like, no.
Why couldn't Matt make it?
For one, he committed to this like Eurovan adventure, and I think that was really the most overwhelming thing. Was like, you know, full bore on that program and that, and just like the expense of pressing pause on what he had going on. He also had a filmer over there, and he was like, "Yo, dog, I can't like just leave this dude in the RV."
Which is why we ended up filming the Mets segment in
Bosnia. It was like our way to get him involved, which is another funny thing that we can talk about in a second. But yeah, ultimately, I think that the location for me didn't matter. It was really just about getting these dudes together. And as it worked out, there's a lot of snow on the ground. And they ended up getting permission to shoot at that school outside of Duluth. And things really worked out. And I think what's really crazy is just to see that the level of skiing in that part is still nuts.
Yeah.
And Wallish, who, you know, throw back to all my stories and some of the other podcasts from... you know, working pretty much around the clock with that dude, just like on some crazy, you know, next level mission goals. Like that's what he was doing. He got there like 3 or 4 days before the other guys did a bunch of scoping and then probably logged a half dozen shots before Casbon showed up.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, just on fire. And, and so, I mean, that's one of the standout parts for me in this movie, just, you know, to have all those dudes back together is just like a really awesome vibe. And the track is sick and the skiing is great. And the cinematography is great.
Where did the track come from?
From Phil,
Yeah. But that was something listeners brought up, is that people wanted to hear more about where songs come from, which is kind of hard to be like...
You would have to have examples because it's all over the place.
Exactly. And it feels weird to flex on them and be like, who did that song? Who did that song? But that's, I think, a notable one to know that it came from one of the athletes.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And,
well, I mean, there was no, Phil is such a, those guys are all so music
particular.
driven, but Phil has such a defined taste in music style and refined. So, it was perfectly easy to give them the reins on that one, soundtrack-wise.
Ahmet in Sarajevo, filming at the old Olympic Park.
Yeah, so back to Ahmet on his Eurovan adventure. Euroventure?
Yeah.
Something like that. Lawfamchan.org.
Closer this time.
Lawfamorg.chan. Check it out.
Lawchannel.fam.
One of those will probably work if you just go type it in.
Dude, that's it. Ahmet. Lawchannel.fam. F-A-F-A-M.
.fam is like, I kind of like that.
Dude, is there a .fam?
There should be.
There should be.
There's a .dot everything.
Can you get like a law.fa? I mean, that's...
Oh, that'd be good too. That'd be real good. Yeah, so I was cruising around Park City shooting with McRae and John Brown and Colby, and Ahmet is like, dude, we're going to Bosnia. We're going to shoot this. They just got like 6 inches of snow. Can you send a filmer? And it's the kind of like phone call you get, like, oh, like Will Weston's like, yo, they just got 6 inches of snow in New York. Can you send a filmer? Except this is like Ahmet. Like,
Bosnia.
Like Bosnia, like FaceTime audio call from some like internet cafe somewhere. Yeah, it's like, dude, like, no, the answer is no. I can't send a filmer to join you tomorrow in Bosnia. Like, come on, dude. Like, and I was still like kind of beating up on him for not committing to this Midwest OG trip. And I was like, dude, no, fuck no. And then this like light goes off in my head. It's like, Danny Cush, and like pulled over on the side of the road and just like sent a Facebook message to Danny. And within like 90 seconds, he's like, yes, I will book a flight. I will be there tomorrow. I was like, yes, dude. And the stars definitely aligned on that one. And I think that Ahmet probably, maybe it was like 2 days it took Danny to get there. Something ridiculous. Yeah. But Ahmet and his filmer spent a couple of days scoping and building and had a few things lined up. And then I think that whole part was shot in 5 days, four of which Danny was there for, and then one more day that those guys shot and just logged a couple more little mini shred clips that made it. Hmm. But yeah, it's kind of crazy. Like pound for pound, I mean, there's a lot of bang for the buck in that part, considering it was shot over 5 days. Like that doesn't normally happen. You can't really, you know, ever count on delivering that kind of thing, you know, a movie part in a couple days. Like that's.
And it had to be its own thing. Like those
very much so.
That was not going so far removed mixed from, with anything else. The scenery, the fact that it's on that. There's no like, one else in there. He doesn't have clips anywhere else.
Guest like, appearance in the Minnesota OG part.
Yeah.
Sprinkling it
a little bit. Yeah. And then props too to Blake Kimmel because, I mean, these like, travel oriented, like pretty far out destination parts. Like the action is really good, but you know, our first take on it was that, you know, it would be a little bit of a challenge to put that together in a part that like really held its own just because of in part the level of action in the rest of the movie. We're talking like everything is like heaters on heaters on heaters. And like, yeah, this stuff it's cool and it's interesting, but is there room for another, you know, sunny turkey part, if you will, that's just more flavor than action necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And Blake came in and did the heavy first cut on that thing. And we all sat down and watched. It was like, oh, damn. Like there is a part in there. There is. And yeah, I'm actually very happy with how that came together. And if you go to Premiere and check it out on a proper system or turn on your headphones or whatever, it's it hits hard. It bumps. Mm-hmm. It bumps.
Yeah, that woofer. It's got some bass.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned filming with McCrae, John Brown, and Colby.
Yeah.
But initially, you were only going there to film with McCrae, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was actually on my way to Cook City, Montana, where Laurent was going to... I think the easiest thing for him was going to be to fly into Salt Lake, and I was going to get a jump start just based on weather and... then we had to move some plans around and I ended up spending, I want to say like 4 days, 3 or 4 days in Utah, with McCrae. And the whole idea was to go into like easy access backcountry and just, you know, let him shred some jumps because that's obviously one of his biggest assets is mm-hmm. his jumping skills. And, you know, he and some of his friends had built some stuff up on Guardsman's Pass, which is like all of 10 minutes from Park City,
right,
where McCrae was staying at Joss's house. And so roll in and he's like, yeah, man, so, you know, my friends Colby and my roommate John, like they kind of built some of this stuff, can they come too? And it's like, yeah, okay, like I don't really love shooting with people, especially in the backcountry, they don't really know. And granted, you know, there are not all the factors that you're normally dealing with on Guardsman's Pass, so it's like, you know, okay, sure, like let's just go do it. And I think the first day we showed up, there's a jump in a zone that had first been done by Stefan Thomas way back in the day. It was his first hit Cab 5 that closed out the Long Story Short trailer and might have opened his part.
Closest part
as well. And and the way, I mean, Guardsman's Pass and the geography, the terrain or topography, if you will, I think, it's very rocky and very sharky. There's a lot of like volcanic, like super sharp igneous rock poking out of everything. And, in order to hit this thing proper, I think you really needed to put like an angle on it, which kind of limited the tricks. And these dudes had just gone ahead and built a fall line cheese wedge with a ton of Wu-Tang on it. And they're just like, yeah, this is what we're going to do. And I'm like, you guys see all those little like specks? Like those are real sharp rocks poking through. You guys know that. Like I actually had like huge reservations even shooting this thing initially. And, they proved very quickly that, they could handle it. And it was one of the wildest sessions. Well, I guess it kind of started off relatively in control, but
is this the jump that opens that segment as well?
This is the one that closes it actually. I had never shot with Colby before. I knew his name and I actually like John Brown. I didn't even realize until I showed up, but he'd sent a super unknown submission that year. Mm-hmm. So we all watched it and it was like, all right, yeah, this kid's legit. Like he can hold it down. But Colby was a huge wild card because I don't think I'd really been very familiar with his skiing. And he opens things up with Dub 10 Lead Japan, which apparently that's never been done in the backcountry, according to those dudes. And they're all like fired up. And Colby's like super hype. He's like, yeah, I think I can triple this. And it's like, oh, no, 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 no. Let's reel it back a little bit. And he's like, well, you know, I'm going to dub 14 it. And it's like, okay, dude, sure, whatever you say. Like, just expecting, you know, either full-on aerials or complete carnage or one of the two. And at that point, there's, like, very little landing left. And you can't tell from where I actually shot it from. But he was threading the needle into the very last patches of fresh snow. And I think it took him two or three tries to ultimately lace this massive dub 14 over these rocks. And yeah, I think it was it Japan to Blunt or Blunt to Japan?
That's a combo. Cuban, I can fucking tell you, but yeah, yeah, there's two grabs in that dub 14 into POW.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, more or less as perfect as you could do that trick. And it's just like, holy shit. Like, my mind was straight up blown. And it's like, oh, is this what goes on these days? yeah. And so that was really cool. And then like the next day they had this other thing, like half built, a skeleton of jump. And we roll up to that thing. And I was like, man, like, this landing's flat. Like, you know, again, like, I never would have built this jump. Like, I don't know. Like, you guys have any idea what you're doing? Like, is this, like, you know, what are we getting into? And, you know, a couple hours of sessioning, and John Brown did a right dub 12, just bolts and McCrated both switch nines or one switch nine. And and a massive dub 10, which he actually laced first hit. But dude's filming the landing angle kind of blew it. Just crying shame. But yeah, talking about blowing shots.
Whoa,
man, that was a bad one. But and then Colby does right switch dub 12 on that one, and a host of other tricks. And it's just like, holy shit! Like, these dudes, for one, like, yeah, this is their game. This is like what they do. But and to be fair, like, the landing wasn't like super deep. It wasn't like, you know. But it was still really impressive. And then they're like, oh, well, let's go build a little step down up here on this cornice. And, you know, I've built dozens of cornice step downs in my lifetime at this point. And it's usual protocol. You like put like a block or two and then like pat it down, and there's your jump. And like, these kids went like eight blocks high and built a full on massive like poppy wedge on top of this cornice step down. And it's just like, once again, like, I don't know if you guys really know how this works here, but I'll let you do it. Like, I'm not going to tell them no at this point, because they've proven me wrong twice. And yeah, and then the next day, actually, Laurent came out and was like, hey, Laurent, you want to hit this? He's like, fuck you guys. And we watch as Colby gets first hit, switch five, second hit, switch nine. And then it took him three tries to get his switch left dub 12, like, to the moon. Like, the takeoff angle is insane, because that's not how you hit a step down. You do not like step on the gas and power into these things. And, and it was absolutely nuts. And I remember thinking to myself, like, is this like what, like, the future of skiing? And is this like, for one, is everybody gonna start doing triples on this thing now? Like, where are we going here? And then it was very quickly a reality check when McCray popped his shoulder out, and he and John Brown just got
served a fucking whooping on that thing.
It was brutal.
For people who've seen the movie, it's the, like,
it's the opening sequence.
The opening crash sequence on the cornice step over. Yeah.
And so my takeaway is like, okay, no. Like, this is actually not how things go. Like, Colby is a fucking freak of nature who's like that good.
Yeah.
And, well, I think you had not been around Young Guns in a while, like, in that sort of setting too.
Well, not in like a, like, real deal, you know, backcountry jump scenario.
Yeah.
And you know,
that's what I mean. I mean, like, you know, 10 years ago, I think that would be, we would have been like aware of Colby. But
sure. But still, man, like, I'd been out like a couple years before with Ben and Laurent, and those dudes are really good skiers. And it's like the same old, like, granted, slightly different backgrounds and different skill sets, but it's like, oh, yeah, just the usual, like, threes and fives and switch fives and sevens, and it's like, all of a sudden, like...
Yeah, Kobe's freak.
Yeah.
Just straight up next level shit.
Word the fuck up.
Yeah. My eyes were opened. I saw the light.
Yeah, it's a cool segment. I think initially there was talk of like working that in with some of the other jump kicker stuff in the movie, but it became evident it needed to be its own thing.
Yeah. Well, again, whenever we go into these movies and then into post-production, it's really a question of like looking at all the pieces of the puzzle and seeing how they're best fit together. And that's where your movie is made in post. Mm. And you can make a infinite number of movies from the exact same shots. And I think that's where, yeah, you either are successful or not. And this year in particular, I think was a big challenge because we probably had more filmers and more athletes and more content and more good content than we've ever had before. Mm. And
oh, not probably. We did.
We did. Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
It was bar none. It was insane.
So it's like, how do you use all this stuff in a way that doesn't burn out your audience and, you know, things still fit together? And we also discussed, you know, to what degree are we going to do rider parts versus theme parts versus location parts versus, you know, how does this all come together? And certainly one of the considerations early on was like, man, are we going to do like this crazy, like backcountry jumping freestyle part? And that was something we talked about, and we definitely did some like long form string outs on. And it just, that was pretty clear that those three jumps just needed to be their own thing. And
self-contained.
Yeah. Very, very much so. Just location, the athletes, the light, the snow, like everything. It was just like, that was one thing. And it's funny because when I shot that, I, for one, was only really initially focusing on McCray, cause like, this is the dude who I'm here to shoot. And like, yeah, your buddies can tag along, but did not even contemplate that I was going to end up putting this all together as a part. And I probably would have done a few things differently, shot a little more B-roll and a little more coverage, but you can never go back and do that after you leave. So
yeah,
I think it worked out really nicely.
Yeah,
it's a thing.
It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah,
yeah, it does. Really bangs you over the head for 2 minutes, and then it's like, oh, bye.
A lot of rotations.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's by nearly impossible to keep track of what tricks they're doing at midway through it, because you're just like, this is insanely nutty. And
but
there's style in it too. It's not just like the Dub 14 is stylish as fuck.
Yeah.
Like it's not just like aerials for the sake of hucking as many spins as you could do. Like it's with it.
No. Yeah. What was also a funny thing on that note is, you know, I was a one person, you know, filming crew at that point. And it's like, man, I bet this looks really fucking sick from the takeoff. And and I was kind of like thinking out loud. Colby's like, do you want me to do it again? I'll go do it again. And I was like, I don't think I want to ask you to do that, man. Like, and I felt like if I had been like, yeah, Colby, go do it again so I can get a takeoff shot, he probably
would have
done it.
The poor man's double angle.
Yeah, but not on that trick. And not with that landing. That was the thing is that, you know, again, just there's zero options left for putting that thing down safely. And he was game to do it, but that was not going to be worth it.
Damn.
Yeah. Props to all those dudes, though. Very impressed. It was awesome. And they got her done.
Other hammer fests in the movie. Keegan Kilbride with just a mega part of, like, culminating his trilogy of appearances, if you will, from Habit and Zigzag, in just like a hell of a finale. You guys have thought, I know, Josh, you shot some of that, but that was mostly E-Money, Ian Every Leaf, and a little Havy as well. That was Havy.
Yep, that's right.
So I'm curious more even just like how what your takes are watching that shit.
My take is that absolutely slaps. Like, that part goes.
Mm.
I love watching that part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's Keegan. That's Keegan, like, fully formed, like Voltron, right there. Like, that's next. That's his best creation to date. And
yeah,
just everything, the song,
part,
the,
I would say.
Way more than his X Games part. His X Games part pales in comparison to that. I just like the way this is put. It's just an excellent street part from Mr. Kilbride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Josh, you shot the QP to DFD. That's the second trick in that segment.
I did.
I think one of the most unique and eye-catching things in me, well, certainly in all the street in the movie. Yeah. What was that session like?
That was, well, for one, a little bit of background. This is a rail feature outside of Denver, maybe like 45 minutes in the suburbs off of 285. And I have a photo in my rail book from like 2007 or 2008 of that thing. And it's really funny because I was talking to those dudes about it, and I had to like go back after the session and send it to them just so we could all laugh. And like the trees are like freshly planted, like little tiny, like, you know, saplings. And they're now like 20-foot tall pine trees.
Yeah.
And,
but you'd never shot that before.
Never shot it. Never shot it. Because for one, it's just like it's a beast of a rail, and it presents all kinds of problems in terms of how to get onto the thing, because the top of the rail crests at the top of this hill. So there's no flat spot. You'd have to hit it from the side, or as a snowboard crew did this year, they like winched up the hill on the other side. I mean, it's just like, There are a lot of X factors, and it's like borderline not worth it. And the rail itself is probably like chest height. It's one of those things where there's like an inside rail and an outside rail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not very friendly. And it's like, it's not really worth, you know, like what are you going to do with this thing? Mm-hmm. And Keegan was like, well, this is what I'm going to do with this thing. I'm going to build two quarter pipes and basically air up onto it and then like redirect down. And I think that was, at that point, the biggest battle of his entire life as far as any feature goes.
Yeah. And he said so, at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then there you go. I remembered correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we were there for an entire day. And the funny thing was, like, in actually editing it, trying to, like, make some of the B-roll match, is just, like, the light changed so much from, like, 11 a.m. to, like, 6 p.m. or something like that, when it was borderline dark out when we left. And, he fought hard for that thing, and it's cool. I mean, it's definitely one of the more unique, you know, also consequential and creative and technical features in the movie. And I think we actually recently sent in our Powder Award nominations and nominated that for Jib of the Year. Yeah, Keegan.
Yeah, buddy. Also on that list, the Will Wesson XL rail jumbo slide. Which we discussed with him when we talked for the Partly Cloudy podcast, sure. But worth a mention that he has one of the most...
He and Kai.
Fire, yeah. Oh, true. Thank you. Yeah. I remember because we talked about
it.
And
Kai got it first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And twice.
Yeah.
And Joe,
will you share the story?
Joe Sexton, the snowboarder.
Mm-hmm. Cover
shot. From a drone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the story he told about why he had ended up getting it twice, Friedel?
To get a cutaway.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were shooting it.
So Kai got the. Will did lip slide to Regs. Kai, Reg to like fake you out or whatever. He got it. I think there was some angle. Havy wanted to get a different angle cutaway shot, so where he'd maybe slide a third of the rail.
Yeah. It's like, just get onto this thing so I can get the angle for the cut.
And then why the shot is the way it is, because it's kind of a funky video shot that I think works absolutely perfect for it. But he basically, Havy's taking the shot, like panning, whatever, from the top. And then Kai doesn't leave the rail. He's still sliding that. So then Havy has to basically readjust.
Reformat.
And start zooming in on the end of the rail. And sure enough, Kai absolutely...
could have slid that thing another 50 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, it's a funny takeaway from what Will mentioned was that the rail was the perfect pitch where you could just maintain this speed. It wasn't too steep that you're accelerating too much. It wasn't too flat that you're like fighting for speed. You just kind of got on it. And I think Will said, he's like, yeah, if that thing was like a lot longer, we probably could have done it.
Mm.
Yeah. Like world record style. Yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of awesome shit throughout that part, though. Some cool cinematography from Johnny showcasing both of their styles, flying that little air blasting.
Yeah, throughout the movie, he did
that too.
That's the only street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where the street showcase is.
A little bit in Finland, a little bit in Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Johnny's goal this year, after opting, well, I mean, really, the cards were dealt the way they were by Canada Parks, and we couldn't actually fly a drone. Mm-hmm. But anyway, not having had any air blaster shots in Zigzag, Johnny really wanted to make an impact on this year's movie. And he wanted to do some backcountry, he wanted to do some street, and then he wanted to cap it off with a park part.
Mm.
And while I think he might not have really crossed everything off his list as he really wanted to in the backcountry, in fact, I can say that for a fact, because our ultimate goal was to take him to Eagle Pass, and we had a trip on the calendar for that that we had to pull the plug on the last second just because it was a really dry, really mediocre year. So that could have been insane, but man, we didn't need it. That's for sure. But yeah, I mean, Johnny showed up and did his thing, and keep harping on this, but he's got an amazing thing going. I don't think there's anybody that can capture action sports, if not, certainly skiing, as well as he can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The shot of Kai, doing a backslide on a Z rail. There's a shot that didn't make it because it wasn't a backslide, but he's doing a follow from the other way and flies like through the rail, and it's one of the coolest perspectives that I've seen, and it speaks to how nutty this movie it is that shit got left on the floor, because in another year they might have been like, oh well, let's maybe run both shots and we can show that dangle in the backslide too, but
yeah,
there wasn't room this year.
Yeah, straight up, there was not room for
anything.
Yeah.
a bunch of things got cut that could have still been like standout moments, because there's like a little question of like, is this perfect? And I think the rule that we kind of made for ourselves at a certain point was like, well, if we're even talking about it, we're just going to cut it.
What else comes to mind?
Laurent and Remco, very early season, went after a rail. Do you know where that rail is?
It's in Switzerland.
Sure.
But I don't know exactly, no.
I know that I first saw it in an Absinthe movie. Wasn't it a cover or an ad or something too?
Could have been. Yeah. Brendan Cocard does it in an Absinthe movie.
Hmm.
Like quite a few years ago now.
Yeah. But it's this like
Brendan Cocard
funky, like not very clean looking rail in this like Swiss village countryside that, could be like 150 feet long, and there's like a little bit of an elbow, a little bit of sea, a little bit, It's very steep.
Yeah. And Laurent, it's an unfriendly version of what Will and Kai hit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very unfriendly. Very
it's steep and has like an awkward curve.
Yeah. Mm. In fact, Remco got taken out on it.
Yeah.
And that put him on the disabled list for a few days, I think. And then Laurent was doing switch tails over the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And switch lip or switch tails?
I feel like it was switch lip.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Switch lip then. And it's funny, like the very end of that rail is so steep. He's coming off, but we ended up watching it so many times in so many ways that it's like he's not on the end of the rail. He comes off maybe like 10 feet from the end, but because of the speed and the steepness of the rail, he lands after the last stair, just like bolts like right to his feet.
Mm-hmm.
And probably felt like he got it, and like certainly looked, if you're not like really paying attention, like he got it. And then he like celebrates like he's got it, and everybody's cheering like mm-hmm. he's got it. It's like, did he get it? I don't even know. And it's the kind of thing that's like, man,
once you see that he doesn't slide the last 10 feet, it's like, yeah, you can't buy into it anymore.
No. Mm. But it's the funny thing, because if we did put that in, I'll tell you what, at the premiere, you could have ended his part with that and everybody would have been like, what?
Oh my God.
Holy shit. And like, it would get that kind of reaction. And you'd probably even still get that from people after the fact too. But then there is this realization for people that care or are looking,
which is
like
a very small but very concentrated vocal minority.
Yeah, fair enough. You're gonna get called out
for good reason.
I see a threat on news scores,
right?
Like, yeah. LeBron didn't even get the rail.
Yeah,
it's like,
God. Level one has lost their step. 15 steps, actually.
but But yeah, Laurent was like, all right, if you guys don't put that in the movie, then don't use it anywhere because I'm going to go back and get it proper. It's like, all right, damn. Good for you. He will.
Yeah.
He will.
Mm-hmm. Heavy Swiss presence in the middle of the movie from those dudes. Yeah. Him, Sammy, and Remco holding it down with mm-hmm. like Laurent backcountry into urban solo part and then a small like Swiss urban mixtape into Sammy backcountry clips into the Ortlieb piece de resistance. I don't know.
Piece de resistance.
All right.
The resistance piece. Yeah. His piece of resistance.
Known around the office as the Snowmation segment.
Yeah, I think he calls it maneuvers for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maneuvre.
Maneuvre. It's going to hang in the Louvre. Yeah.
Very cool watch. And it's gotten some really cool, really cool feedback. What's your take on that, Friel?
I just know that Sammy has had ideas like this for years and years and years, several years. He's done a mini version. He always does with a lot of basically all of this trilogy of concepts that he's done. The Endless Pump Track, the Water World, and now this animation. He's done a version of it in the past in a Birds edit or, you know, one mm-hmm. of his personal movies. Mm-hmm. And then he sort of just beefs it up like and throws everything at it that like Level One can give him to make it a real movie part. But yeah, he when I first saw the examples he had done a couple of years ago in the Birds movies, it was really, really dope. And he's like, yeah, I kind of want to go all in and do this as a full feature part because the stuff he had done was short and that stuff mm-hmm. takes an incredible amount of time.
Yeah. Can you give us a rundown on like what is actually happening there to create that whole piece? For the interested parties who will be listening to this podcast.
It's all just CGI. Yeah. No, well, that I think is a misconception that some of that is a lot of CGI, which, yeah, you could certainly do it that way, but it would take,
it'd probably look more perfect, but more fake.
Yeah.
And I think part of the effectiveness is a little bit of like very minor imperfection where you can actually see that this is really being physically done.
Yeah, they're doing everything in reverse. Essentially, they're setting because of light and changing. Yeah, you know, light conditions is the biggest thing with compositing these animations. They are, you know, stop motion taking apart a jump after they hit it, immediately after they hit it, and they have to step out of frame. So for they're shoveling for a minute, then stepping out, and they're trying to disperse the snow in a way, in a not natural way, where it basically doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then breaking branches off of trees, bending branches. They spin a pillar, which is...
Like a pillar of snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you'll see it in the park, but that is very much they spun a pillar around. They had built this pillar on a little tarp. So they could then take a legitimate spinning animation of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't even realize
they manually turned Jesus. That thing. So
I thought
that's
they were
why
just rebuilding it. But
no. That would have been insane.
I thought that was some kind of CGI.
That was not. No, wow, they manually turned this pillar so that it had realistic shadows Damn. On each side as it spun around. Yeah.
That's hardcore.
Yeah.
That's
super hardcore.
Sick,
but
though.
I mean, he ended up filming that part over the course of probably like 6 weeks or something like that.
Probably even a little more, and then editing it over the course of 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to ask Sammy like how much time we actually spent in post on that, because this was very unique in a number of ways. For one, like conceptually. For two, the bulk of this was really done outside of the office. Mm-hmm. And it was probably more so than any other part that we've ever worked on, a situation where we were more or less just handed a part. And it's like, here you go, from an outside source.
Mm.
And, you know, we did color grading, we did a little bit of sound design and like a tiny, tiny bit of editing just to like tighten some stuff up just to make it flow a little better in the context of the movie. But mm-hmm. otherwise, this was really just like Sammy's work.
Yeah.
It was very cool.
Which is not normally the case that people edit their own parts in a completely different country.
No, absolutely not.
Not level one, anyway.
No, yeah. Feel very, very privileged that Sammy put all that time and effort into this contribution for us. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, he's a creator in his own right. So having him do this this point with this concept is like, yeah, full trust situation. Like, take the ball and run with it, man.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you know you're going to get something really, really cool out of it.
Yeah, he worked with a local group to compose the soundtrack for it, and just like every aspect of that was very, very curated and designed.
Mm.
And made from scratch, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a custom as it gets.
It's all CGI.
Yeah. Even the skiing.
Yep.
I've had
it's a deep fake.
Yeah.
I've had several people ask me after seeing that Snowmation part, the opening part of the Sierra Park segment has this pump track style opening to it with all these people flying around, crisscrossing, like eight people in the frame at once. And people are like, is that fate? Did they animate that too?
I have also gotten this.
Yeah. Really?
Because I think your belief is suspended a little bit with scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Turning pillars and people crisscrossing jumps. Yeah.
Josh, how'd you fake that?
that took a lot of time, let me tell you.
I'm sure it took a lot of time doing it real.
Yeah, we had motion control rigs that we had suspended from the trees. And yeah, we had rotating snow pillars on tarps. And we had wardrobe there just rotating outfits on the two skiers. And for one, hats off to Sierra and Tyson and Sarah and everybody there for really, putting together an awesome shoot for us and really indulging our interest in doing something a little different. And that pump track thing was very much something that I wanted to do to give Johnny an opportunity to fly his POV drone and just do something, really different and really like harness the potential of this, like, camera moving through trees and athletes and features in a way that you couldn't do a couple of years ago. And then we really just like give people a really crazy new perspective. And it's funny though, watching it, he flies so well and so smoothly that it almost like doesn't appear to be as crazy as it actually was. Like
could be a follow cam if you were skiing perfectly.
Yeah, like you could have probably like put a track next to it for some of these shots and like timed it in such a way, if you could manage to get that speed, which you actually couldn't,
right?
To where like, yeah, I mean, Johnny's flying underneath McRae when he's doing a half cab on the second jump, and it's like, underneath people's legs and over their shoulders, and it's just like, yeah, you could probably convince somebody that that was like some dude with a GoPro on a stick.
Yeah.
But that was really not the case. And so that was really inspired by a bunch of the pump track stuff that we've done in the past and trying to put together, a combination of what we saw in, less. I'm like drawing a blank right now.
Small world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just take a little bit of what we've learned from a few of these different shoots and just do like this ultimate BMX pump track. And actually, I don't think it came together as well as I would have hoped, but it was like we were running two different park shoots at once.
Mm.
So actually the end result is awesome. And, cheers to everybody for all the hard work, but I want to go back and do it bigger and better. but it was really cool. It really was. And, it ultimately just became this like introduction to the part itself, which was this ginormous feature that Tyson dreamed up. And, again, like an awesome jump with a bowl and a hip and a rail and a wall and a whole mess of trannies. And, I think our goal with that was to build another feature that was like a singular location, a single pile of snow that you could hit a number of different ways.
Hmm.
And we did.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool aerial shots in there, both from Johnny and Ian. And
yeah, well, I think that's where Johnny's stuff shines even more, is because he could really just like open it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, didn't have the confines of, you know, the tight trees and trying to follow like a group of people. And that was another thing that was a huge challenge, is like whenever you have a half dozen or more people doing something at once, like what is the percentage of time that like everybody nails their shit? It's like right. One time, like, oh, John Brown just like catches an edge and goes off. And yeah. One time, like, Will doesn't have enough speed. And one time,
miss a grab. McCray
missed a grab. Like, you know, and like Benny, like, I don't know, like every, it was a huge challenge in editing as well, because you had different groups of people on different days. And one day some person wouldn't come up because they were sore, or tired, or hungover. And the next day, like, this other person wouldn't come up. And some days somebody was doing front flips, and the next day they were doing back flips. And it's just trying to put together a somewhat believable, cohesive edit from all these different takes and all these different light conditions and all these different angles. And I don't know. I mean, Friedel, you weren't there. You just kind of saw it. Does it look like it's all kind of one thing, or like how?
Yeah, man, it's all just hectic. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
There's too much happening to notice anything.
Like, I am not picking out inconsistencies.
Man, also the other thing from a, you know, just filmmaking production side note, grading on that and actually making it all look like it fits together was probably one of the biggest challenges I've had, because you have a GoPro, you had DJI Osmo, you had a Red Epic, you had a Red Gemini, you had Inspire 2 with an X4, I think, and just like,
now you're really speaking alien talk, dude.
But let's just say we had like five different cameras, all with, well, the Reds were the same, but like just different picture profiles and a different look, and just like, holy shit, like I thought for a little while that we weren't going to be able to use like certain angles and certain cameras just because it looked so different. And yeah, that was not easy. That was actually a big challenge in grading this movie in general, is because you had so many different people filming with different cameras and different formats and
picture profiles, and
yeah absolutely. And to make something that looks somewhat cohesive is and easy, but it's super important, because otherwise it looks like this hodgepodge of like shit.
Yeah, a checkered blanket.
Yeah.
I
just mentioned real quick just about Emil. You know, it was really cool to be able to give him an opportunity to work with us and be in the movie this year, because he's been on it for a while. And we go back to Super Unknown 10 with him, where he was in Sun Valley, the year that Magnus won. And at that point, I think he was the ripe age of 16 or something like that. And one thing I do remember from him on that shoot is that he was like all or nothing, and he always had these really cool ideas to do something, and I don't think any of them actually worked out, but he was like the first one up and the last man standing trying to get his shot, and he never could quite do it. But you know, I remember that was my big takeaway from him at that shoot, is like, man, like he's got such a cool vision and he's got really good style. And that one day this kid is gonna like come into his own, and he definitely has. And it's really cool to been able to give him that opportunity, and to also really cool too to hear a lot of people hyped on what he did. Like that was one of the things that Parker and CeeLo pointed out, and it's another thing that a lot of people have mentioned to me, and in part probably because he's a fresh face. And I think that there's a lot of value in having a fresh face with a style that you haven't seen before.
Well, I mean, that's how Level One got started, right?
That's
how we had a name for a while. And I think probably of lately we've like aged with our people, and there has been less fresh faces. Which is just a natural progression of things. But yeah.
Lucas Wachs being another fresh face in this movie. Yeah. I think people were really stoked on his part.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
It's a classic Stone Cold Hammer fest. Cut from a very classic cloth, I feel like, with just like really big, well executed, you know, featured jumps, natural features, all the good stuff, pillows.
It's got it all.
Really sick line.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, no Parker Street, obviously, but no, as far as the backcountry part goes, that thing is like 100.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really dope.
And it's funny how you mentioned like aging with our current crew, in that, especially when people like Parker and CeeLo, for example, come back into the fold, and it's like, ooh, like we got to give these guys a lot of attention because they're the fucking best and they're our friends and we love them. That makes it that much more of a challenge to introduce new people because, you know, you have this well-oiled machine working over here. It's like, do we need this? Like, are we going to potentially try to take resources away from these people that we, you know, already have these commitments to? And like, where do you draw the line? And the really funny backstory about how Lucas even got involved with us is that about this time last year, we were talking to Carl Fosvet. He's one of the people that I've personally had on my like list for a long time of people who I think are just the upper echelon of what's cool in skiing that we've never worked with, never had any kind of relationship with him. And, you know, he mentioned to me, he's like, hey man, like, you know, maybe there might be an opportunity to do something with Level One. It was just like, yes, fuck yeah. Like this would be amazing. And a little ways into the fall, maybe even as far in as December, like we were still trying to figure out exactly what that would look like. And I think it was actually right before Christmas, got a call from Carl. He's like, hey man, like, I don't know how to quite say this, but, I think I'm going to work with Matchstick this year.
And, are you breaking up with me, Carl?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because he's like, he said he was like nervous and he thought I was going to be all upset. And it's like, oh yeah, like that's a bummer. Like real hyped on the idea of working with you. But I mean, what Matchstick did with their movie this year is they scaled things down to focus on four riders.
Yeah.
And they came to Carl and were like, hey man, we would like to offer you a 15-minute segment in our movie. And, you know, whereas
you can have one quarter of our film.
Yeah, pretty much. And then on the other side, like we're trying to figure out how to like
film with 80 different people.
Yeah,
for sure.
And give them that all want to go in as hard AF.
Yeah.
And like do the most that they possibly can. And we still have the same amount of resources.
Yeah.
So it was a relief. Working with Carl would have been fucking dope, but it was a relief that's like somebody like that needs a lot. Like of resources because he deserves it.
It was the best thing for him. And I that's all I had to say. I was like, man, that is a great opportunity. Like, good for you. Like, I'm real bummed that, you know, we don't get that opportunity this year, but you know, these guys will give you your due and like, you know, yeah, like no hard feelings at all. And, you know, prior to that conversation, you know, he had mentioned like, oh yeah. And like, and Lucas wants to shoot with us too. And that was like, oh my God, another athlete, like another one on top of another one on top of another, like
DJ Khaled.
Like, how are we going to do this?
Because they've been a package deal for a couple of years, making short films together.
Yeah, they had just made Stray Dogs, which came out last fall.
Yeah. So. And it was like, oh my God, how are we going to like give another commitment to another person who's clearly like very good and like, again, operating the backcountry, which takes a lot of time and resources. And it's just like, holy shit. And then the piece of the puzzle just kind of fell into place. I know that I crossed paths very briefly with Lucas up in Revelstoke early season and just kind of like, you know, he messed around with our crew for a couple of days and
broke the ice.
And I think a couple of those shots actually ended up in the movie. But things really got going after that when he was able to work with Pete Alport, who he's got a, you know, longstanding relationship with and kind of became
both Oregon boys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say I had no idea really what to expect, but I think that Lucas's part really speaks for itself. I think that it was a wild card for everybody and we had no idea what we were getting into. And then when we put this timeline together, it's like, oh damn, like it, you know, short and sweet, but just like firepower start to finish. And again, it's a person who's never been seen in a Level One movie. So there's so much value in that. Like, you know, you have the same people, even if they're doing the best tricks with the best style, like my eyes are used to seeing them. And then you have somebody a little bit different come in. It's like, yeah, like maybe he's been doing dub 12s, granted not in the backcountry, for his entire life, but I've never seen what that looks like. Like, so this is all new to me, and I think it was really cool to see what he put together and stoked that we were able to give him that platform.
How hard did he work for that dub 12? I know he
worked so hard. Oh my God. I think there are probably, what, 3, 4, maybe 5 different jumps that he built throughout the season that he was trying dub 12s on. And the one that finally connected was the last thing he shot, I think, in like mid-April. Mm-hmm. Yeah, early April.
Close to it.
Mid-April, yeah.
Mid-April, yeah.
Yep, in the Whistler backcountry. And, I mean, that's just like, you know, a season's worth of effort coming together. And I know that and Wiley was there as well. And I think Wiley tells a story that he thought that they were going to have to take him to the hospital. It was this thing where like, oh, he's going deep. He's going real deep, but he's like super composed. And you don't even know, especially, I think that Wiley was probably standing near Pete, which is that head on camera angle. You don't have this side perspective. So you can't quite tell how deep somebody's really going until they land. But Wiley, like for a fraction of a second, it's like he has overshot this thing and he's going to explode. Mm. And just like, we're going to have to like evac him.
Yeah, we're going to be picking up parts like Mr. Potato Head.
but that's not how the story ends, and he stomps the bejesus out of this thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Puts the exclamation point on it.
Yep.
Friedel, filming, I believe this is the second backcountry ender in a row, the other being Parker's and Zigzag, where there are no drone shots.
Yeah, it's old school.
Yeah, I assume that's pretty deliberate on your end. It's going to be...
No, I didn't really ever think about it in that way, but...
But you don't take a... There's no drone in your kit, right?
Right, that's correct, yeah.
He's been cut off?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
I just am a little more traditional film style, but I think as droning gets super advanced, I let the pros a la Air Blaster do the good stuff. I try to diversify my filming as much as possible via follow cams or whatever else.
Mm-hmm. That was the hot shit.
Mm-hmm.
Which I quite enjoy some of the shots I got this year doing that, but no drone. Yeah. Traditional style more so, but a lot of that, I don't think would have necessarily even benefited, like for in the LSM, like Lucas Stole Madison, the other Lucas's part. I don't see a lot of shots there that necessarily would have benefited from like a crazy drone shot.
No.
Because they kind of speak for themselves and they're done in an environment where almost like the skiing is what's really doing the tricks there.
Right. Which is the how the drone can capture the landscape.
Yeah. Yeah.
But often doesn't focus on the skiing as well.
Yeah, it's more of an intense POV of it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, well, I enjoy that because it's easy to lean on that tool very hard, because filming backcountry stuff, having something where you can just pop up and all of a sudden you don't need to worry about where you're standing, getting in a good spot, like where am I going to get the best vantage for this line? It's just like, oh, I have this magic like tool that's going to go fly around and go exactly where I need it to be. And then that ease of it has made it so ubiquitous in ski cinematography these days that I think it wears to see those just like head on top view perspectives over and over and over.
Yeah. You get detached from reality in a sense, or like a grounded sense of like being there or whatever.
Right.
And it's like, it can skew the perspective a lot. I like having a more firsthand perspective on something that feels intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those, yeah, like in, Parker's part's not quite a good example of this, but like in LSM's part in Romance, like you have a lot of stuff that's intimate. He's not doing some crazy big line or anything like that.
But seeing how he's using his skis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You almost want to, like, some of his stuff, I was like even wanting to shoot tighter and tighter and tighter and get in as close as possible. You know, the opposite of like a lot of drone filming or whatever else, just to like capture the nuances of that stuff or the style of it.
Mm.
So, yeah, that kind of, which well, I really yeah, enjoy
it,
too.
It, yeah, it's important for the part because it, yeah, it's such an exclamation point on the end of the movie, and it's, there's so much creativity in it that to have that like proximity to what's happening is, I think, pretty crucial. But I don't know. Let's talk about the skiing more too, like, cause that
Lucas Stole Madison, we'll just call him LSM, I guess, because that's what he used to go by. And there's a bit of some confusion here with the Lucases, but he I mean, obviously made a name for himself, certainly with Level One movies, as being a really fresh ass street skier in Less and Partly Cloudy. And that, like, when he left to go back with a bunch and then do some of his own stuff, it was like, oh, I knew that he had like goals in mind of what, how to sort of take that perspective that he had in street and transfer that into Powskeen. And there was unfinished business there in a lot of ways, which he was getting it done, like his, you know, his brunch interpretation part and his the Yugen movie that he made in Japan last year, both super good examples of that. But when he got the opportunity to go to him with Japan, I knew that it was going to be something special, and it certainly was. He just has it's like that cat reflex combined with a really cool way of looking at stuff. And I know that's kind of overused, like, oh, he looks at things differently or whatever, but it's entirely true, because I've never seen people that can make such a joy out of a small, simple landscape like he can. And certainly, I mean, you need it helps to have soft snow, but Japan is like, a lot of people, and even Parker to a certain extent, got like bored there because, you know, there's not a lot of places to really like open it up and like rip and like kind of feel the adrenaline rush type shredding. But like LSM is perfectly content. Obviously, he wants he can do that all too, but he can also, you know, take a little mushroom and make it a magical little thing. So that was just addictive filming that stuff.
There's a couple poppers that are like first or second try. One that's obviously very first try, and then his ender, which I believe is second.
So he actually, that 180 to like switch flare out, he had tried like a week and a half earlier on that mushroom and came like an inch away from Bolt stomping it. And we didn't get it, so we went back like a week and a half later. I actually extended my ticket in Japan. Not just for that, but it was definitely like, let's keep this going, because we're onto a good thing here. And we let it reset, which in Japan, in late January, certainly does. And even a big pillow, but he went back.
3 hours later.
Set it up. Set it up differently.
We went up for another run.
But he did take two tries on that. And thank God the pillow held for the second try, because obviously you see what happens there. When he fully like put his meat into it, that thing shattered, but it made for a beautiful moment.
Yeah. So on the topic of extending your flat, just kind of continuing to ride the wave, I know that originally his plan was just to hang out for the Japan trip. And I remember hearing from both you and Parker being like, Lucas is on it for like an opener or a closer. Like, this dude is just murder mission. Like, and you're like, we want to keep this going.
Yeah. I mean, there was no, like, we had, I think that LSM will say the same thing, but it's like, oh, this is like the moment we've all been waiting for. This is, pure magic.
It's awesome, and momentum and vibes.
Momentum and you know, like, why stop a good thing? And I talked about it before in podcasts, but it's like really cool when you can shape something over the course of a season with somebody and be really involved, not just as like a person pointing a camera, but just be involved with a person's like creation.
Documentation to teamwork.
And it's way more than just being like a hired gun.
And I think you can see when those parts develop and evolve, and even in the course of this movie, I think there are a bunch of very clear examples of parts where they are very developed, and you can see that. And then there are other parts that are just really underdeveloped because there was not that teamwork. It was just people documenting, which again you'll get, especially when you have the list of athletes and filmers as long as this was. You just don't have everybody having a connection, everybody really like holding hands and singing Kumbaya and working together.
You also just, not everyone can have like a personal filmer type situation. So it's like, doesn't always happen, but it's certainly something that I've done in the past with Tatum and Parker, as we discussed. And
but even some people that did have a personal filmer. Right. That's something that doesn't always translate.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, it was, yeah, we wanted to keep that going. And I mean, in the reality of it, he didn't film a ton throughout the year because there was a huge gap kind of between Japan and then when he started filming again, which was later in the winter in Riksgränsen in northern Sweden, because we were going to try to do a trip to the Alps that didn't pan out for weather reasons. And then, he just ended up splitting his locations into two parts. And that was a month in Hokkaido and like a month and a half, 2 months in Riksgränsen, sort of over the course of late winter into late spring all the way through May, which I later joined up. I went to Sweden in May, shot him at Clapin at Kimbo Sessions, and then we did the trip up to Rick's with Crypto.
Yeah.
And kind of put the cap on it. But it was, I mean, it definitely made one of my more favorite memorable ways of showing skiing that I can think of. And man, I mean, that just juices you up. You talk about burning out or whatever, or making the same thing over year after year. That is just a perfect example of like, oh, this is an entirely new thing. This is giving me, I feel like a little kid watching this and being a part of this. Mm-hmm. There's like that right there is why, just, I don't know, it gets me excited. Like, and certainly that excitement, Lucas brought this year, and I think why we gave him the ender. If you look at the shape of the movie, we sort of roughly did this past, present, future thing, where we had, you know, it's a very loose structure and a loose interpretation of that structure, but you're starting off the intro with very old, with archival footage.
Yeah, it's just retro. Well, the intro itself.
And then you're starting with like the OG of OG crews in the current age anyway.
Right.
And then it slowly fades. You know, at the end where we have not only new blood, but like newish blood, like Keegan and Lucas Walks. And then you have Crypto and that whole crew in Rick's. And then it goes into Lucas, which he's not a new blood by any means, but I do feel as though that form of skiing is certainly a new take.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you.
And
there.
It speaks to the future and not less to the past.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. That's what it is. It's just future shit.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that he's like, you know, how old he is or appearances, like the skiing and everything that's going on in there. It's just like magic.
Yeah.
It's future shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Favorite shots that you got all season long?
Lucas, LSM, that like manual like tail ride he does into that 180.
Like, yeah, the revert through the cloud.
Yeah, it just was such a cool moment. I actually dug out a hole in the snow. So I was on, this camera was sitting on the surface level of the snow.
Wow.
So you like have this frame of crystals kind of before him.
Mm-hmm.
And then just how he does that is such a unique like way of doing a very simple maneuver in snow. But the way the light was and where we are that day on this ridge, like in the middle of nowhere in Japan, was just a magical special. And it just was like, oh, this is pure beauty and magic before my eyes, like in such a simple way. The other shots I really enjoy are the session with Parker and Chris on this jump in Utah where I was doing follow cams, and
it
just was one of those days where like, this is it. This is awesome. Just doing follow cams on this jump, which is a very rare opportunity in powder.
Mm-hmm.
But then like for like Parker's Misty 5 on that jump, just a beautiful trick. Same with Chris's like underfillet blunt 5, cork 5.
It's such a rad shot. I'll tell you, like that session is something that I hear people talking about. Like, those shots are so sick.
Yeah.
It's true. It's a very simple perspective. Like, there's nothing new about what you're working with in 2019 that allowed you to do that wasn't there 20 years ago even, but it's just so nicely done. What was it that made you want to do or decide to do follow cams on that jump and do them in that particular way? Because here's my reason for asking that is that, especially as a one-man band, I or we collectively in that situation are always trying to find the balance between getting a shot that's new and cool and a special shot and making sure you're getting the action. Because let's say Parker does that Misty 5 one time and gets it, like there's a risk involved in doing a follow cam or doing anything different.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, finding that balance is not easy. It's something that I always struggle with, and just curious where your headspace was at.
Yeah, it was out of a mixture of not wanting to shoot a boring angle on a jump because we had built a couple other jumps, and it's like, well, this is just lame. Like, we got that. And need to mix it up here. So when we built that jump, I had a couple days. We built it in a storm. I had days to think about it. And so I knew to bring my skis to that jump and I at least was going to test it out because I was like, I think I can do a follow cam on that jump. And I actually mentioned it to those guys before we even went there to hit it. And they fully backed that idea. Again, very supportive of like trying new angles and stuff. And then I was like, all right, guys, like when the session was getting going and they were, you know, slipped out the in run and stuff, I gave it a speed check. All right. I tested out the slope on the side and it had this perfect non-knuckle rollover to the skier's left so that I wasn't ever like in fear of airing or catching my tips or something like that. And it took one like just dry run before they hit the jump down that thing. And I was like, oh yeah, that was smoother than riding down Breck Park or whatever. Like this is on. I was like, let's stay. Yeah, I mean, and then from then on, like every shot, we was just like, yep, watch that. Yep, yep, yep. Oh, it was a beautiful.
Did you
thing.
Sled lap to do that, or were you hiking? Okay,
sled lap. Yeah, okay. It was kind of a bitch, but yeah. Hiking would have been exhausting.
Right. That's why I ask. Yeah. It's not really.
No.
Yes. Yeah, so you got to have some love from the team to like be
Yeah. And Thane Rich was there as well. I should add, he just had a rough go of it, but he helped out a bunch in sled lapping too. So they had to just take a little, it was a slower process for them to hit the jump because I was involved, but it was well goddamn worth it.
Yeah. Damn right.
Yeah.
You need a sec, Josh?
Just like 50 things going on. Jesus Christ. We got all kinds of sponsors using content online that they're not supposed to. Whoa. And just, come on, people. Get on the program.
If you're going to abuse the content, why bother paying for it? Just bootleg it. That's my take.
Well, because they think by paying something to be supporting the movie, this is something they get in exchange, even though it's never discussed, and they just like say one thing and do another. And come on, we're all on the same team here, people. Let's work together. Anyway, so to answer your question, favorite shots from the year.
Man,
hard to really answer that. I don't feel like I had any of these like super magical moments, but I do know like Colby's Dub 14 that we already talked about. I mean, that was something where the light was insane. There are these just like micro frozen suspended
diamond dust,
you know, diamond dust just like everywhere. And it was just like this beautiful day where the cloud level was actually like 50 feet below us. And I think that's what we were seeing actually was like the cloud layer moving in, but it never fully made it in. And so just like everything about that was just really cool and really special. And of course, just like, I don't know how often I'm sort of just blown away by a trick. And that was just something I would have never expected. If we rolled up and somebody was like, yeah, like you're going to walk away with a Dub 14 double grab on this thing, be like, you're lying. So, I mean, that was cool just to really be surprised and impressed, which doesn't happen enough. And I don't know. Let's see. There's a shot of Rainville, this top-down drone shot. I've always wanted to do like a semi-static shot on top of a huge pillow stack with somebody just dropping in. Because that to me is a new perspective that I haven't really seen much. And again, really just kind of choosing to limit yourself with the drone and not like doing more than the most basic shit.
Right.
And in that case, I was flying the drone and running a ground angle at the same time. and like really, really cold temperatures, like, you know, borderline, I'm probably like single digits where my batteries were giving me like 5 minutes at a clip and that was it. And so popping that thing up and getting the shot and then also getting the ground angle at the same time was really cool because Rainville wasn't so sure, I think, about that stack and wasn't really feeling 100%. And so it's like, man, this is probably just not going to work. And like, you know, we were dealing with all kinds of sled issues and Rainville sled blew up and then my sled wasn't running and just like the world was conspiring to shut us down. It's like, I want this shot. And to have it actually work out was nice. Yeah. It was nice. Not that it's like some wild.
That is a great example of not just running back the same shit and using the drone to find something creative with it.
Yeah.
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 Because I like that one too.
Yeah. But I also think like, some of these shots or these things that we've talked about, I mean, the experience on the back end almost rarely does it translate into exactly what the viewer picks up on. And I think that's been sort of some of the magic of these podcasts is being able to tell these stories of all of these things and adding a little bit of substance to like the 3 seconds that people actually see.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah. Like, that costs like 2 weeks in a sled engine and and like 2 crash drones and like a corrupted hard drive to get that shot.
Yeah.
I should add another, I want to add another fair shot in the mix. And this is not based on like a cinematography thing necessarily, but, Crypto, aka Eric Moberg's, Scandi Panther flip.
Yeah.
Aka the Scandi Panther. Yeah.
The rock roll.
The dirt knuckle and Rick's, that like tip slap to, I don't even,
it's cork just, something.
Yeah. To shouldn't have stomped was such a wild moment to capture.
Oh yeah. I gotta ask you about that. There's a shot of him kicking at the dirt.
Yeah.
You got his like B roll cutaway. Yeah. Did you ask him to do that?
No.
Really?
No. He tried that probably 8 times, 9 times.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, hovering over, like doing this like weird bio off axis, like bio 5 thing that he does, and it's very blind. And he was not getting the
slap,
the pop here was popping too much and not getting the proper like dirt slap. So he went up there to like look at it and like look where he should carve to. And he's like, I gotta do it right there. And he like kicked the dirt, like, I gotta do it. So that was what that moment was from.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's sick. It's so perfect that it made me be like, that's staged. There's no way that he just went up there and was like, oh, kick it at the dirt, figuring it out.
Yeah.
Sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dope.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also assume that was like a cutaway after the fact, like, oh, come up here and just like kick the dirt for me.
Right. Yeah.
Just to like emphasize, like show like a little foreshadow.
That makes it even cooler. Learned going through all the archival stuff, searching for clips for the intro, is that you, Berman, are the king of asking people to do stuff like that. Like, be like, yo, can you say that again? That was really funny. Let me get that on camera. Can you go do that again? Can you help me out here? Like, especially the early days, which is like stuff I was looking at a ton.
Sure.
And there's, it's really interesting to me because I think that's a very underrated, like, I don't know, like, it's uncomfortable asking people to do that, especially when they're your friends. But like, I think the payoff can be huge for like capturing stuff on camera that otherwise would have gone just like into the people's memory banks.
Sure. I think that there's a fine line there. And, cause I think we've talked about this, Friedel, you and I in particular, just like asking people to do something again that you've almost missed or that didn't happen just so you can get it.
You can't recreate a moment.
No. So,
and they're not actors.
Right. Yeah. So I'm wondering like to what extent, cause like I try really hard to not like ever try to be like, oh, that was really funny. Like say that again. Like, so if I was saying that early years, then I definitely learned to avoid.
You did it in the early years, and I think you learned
that's not a thing you should do.
Yeah, or you're going to get some backlash from the people you're asking at a certain point.
Sure. Like, well, it just like takes away. It's like it's not natural.
Right.
And like you said, these guys are not actors. So I probably learned that pretty quickly. But I am not shy to ask people to, you know, do something for a B-roll shot or a cutaway. And that's not to say like, hey, repeat this crazy trick that, you know, I want another angle. Because we just discussed, like, with that Dub 14 again, like, yeah, there's a line there. And, like, you just got to be ready to get something when it actually happens. Mm. But as far as just coverage in general, like, painting a picture and capturing content of, like, everything that's going on, like, you can't always be rolling on everything at all times.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need help in, like, recreating something, whether it's, like, you know, an in-run cut. I mean, that's something that I always made a point to do. And at this point, you use, like, 2% of them because, you know, we've seen them a million times before. But it's a nice thing to have when you have a beat you need to edit to. And there's, like, one more thing. It's like, oh, dude is standing there, and then dude hits the jump, and then there's this beat. And I don't want to see the jump on screen for another, like, 2 seconds. Mm. And so, like, I've always tried to be over prepared for post and, like, editing things in my head and knowing, like, all right, I got to connect the dots with this shot and, like, we need this filler. Like, it's going to happen and this is what I got to do.
Mm. Word.
So yeah, I often find that I edit stuff in my head while I shoot.
Hmm. Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Last question. Is this the best level one movie ever so far?
I can't answer that right now. That's for sure.
That's another thing that time will help tell.
It has to. I just can't say that with confidence because all the other movies you're comparing it to have been filtered by time. Yeah. So you can't make a direct comparison necessarily. You could, for sure. I could be like, yes, it's the best of all time.
Yeah.
But I don't feel comfortable doing that.
Mm.
I think it's one of the best for sure and is in the running. But what do you think? You've seen them all now. I think we went out with a bang, that's for sure. I have full confidence in that.
That was the goal.
Yeah.
I don't think people will regard it as, because there's always the lens of nostalgia that makes you love what you saw first.
This is the first thing that I saw, and this made me want to ski.
You're totally right, because I think that is a point I wanted to make, that I think level one, and it's certainly over the years how they have stacked on, like, we will always be known for, like, these now semi-historical movies, like the older stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that being said, it is. It's not really a contest. Like, I don't think it's cohesive. It's got emotion. It's got all of the action you could possibly ever want.
And more.
Yeah. It's edited well. The soundtrack's good. It is.
It's a very level one movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's a very level one movie. to double dip.
Weird up. All right. Well, any final words for our listeners?
Oh, yeah. I will mention that going into this movie and throughout the process of making this movie, I would go back and forth many times over between feeling like, all right, we are going all in. I am going all in. Like, I'm going to prioritize this fucking movie above anything else that I've got going on in my life.
Mm.
And then also being like, does anybody even care?
Mm.
Like, we are going to make this movie and then, like, press the reset button and life will continue in one direction or the other. Does it make a difference if I pack my bags right now and drive through the night to get a shot tomorrow morning because it's going to be really good? Does that fucking matter? Or should I just, like, sleep for a couple of days and sit in the office and do work? And I would go
send, like, fucking emails.
Yeah. And really, like, it was a thing. It's like, does this even matter? Like, is this movie, like, it's just going to be a movie. I know that. Like, how much do I need to, like, put into it? I mean, we've, you know, talked about my overcommitment to just, like, doing things over the years. And, like, for the first time, if ever, it was like, man, does it make a difference? And really, it was like, does anybody care?
I've had that existential thought the last couple of years, especially in the Instagram age, where it's like, does what we're doing here, we are all passionate about it, everyone involved in is into it, but is it ultimately, doesn't any matter anyway, because you're I've always considered this, you're simply making entertainment. You're not doing something necessarily greater than that. But does that entertainment matter is the question I think we're asking here. And that definitely starts, if you start to question yourself, that can be depressing.
Yeah. Well, that too. And it's like, well, regardless, we're going to make a movie. Like, are people going to see it? Are they not going to see it? Either way, people are going to look back and say, Level One has this awesome 20-year legacy.
Right.
Like, it would take, like, a disaster of a movie for people to be like, oh, like, Level One sucks.
Well, I mean, you could literally come out with a trailer and still have a 20-year legacy.
Yeah. Sure. But that was the thing. It's like, how much, like, does my effort matter at this point?
Yeah, and, totally.
And every time I answer that question with yes, and I, like, got in my car, and I went and I did whatever it is I needed to do, and I'm really glad I did. But, and it's like, do people even watch this beyond the trailer? Like, does the next, like, phase of my life, do how many of our sponsors that are even writing these checks or exchanging emails with me, do they even see the movie? I don't know.
Mm. Right.
I don't know.
Right.
So how do you feel about that now? With three weeks of it in, like, the rear view of,
well, I'm done. Really, really glad. Like, you know, it was to some extent an existential question, but I can't say no. That's the thing, is like, no matter how many times these questions popped into my head, you know, the answer to me ultimately was like, well, yes, I'm just going to, like, you know, drink more coffee and stay up longer and go out, freeze my ass off more and get the shot. And then same thing with editing this summer. It was just, you know, I probably took on more of a edit role, post-production role than I have in many, many, many years. Mm. And you know, I think I started doing 12-hour days July, like early July.
Not every day, but it was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for damn sure.
I'll tell you what gave the win, though, with editing, because it was hard to edit this movie because there was, A, so much footage to watch, but also there was this weird pressure of it being the last one of its kind. And it's like, how do you even start that to live up to the hype of such like that, or expectation, or even self expectation for what that is?
Sure.
Right. And like, what gave us wind, I think, in the sales there was the teaser drop, was, which was such an old school classic teaser drop that kind of captured the zeitgeist for a couple weeks there. It felt like that hasn't happened in a long time in that way, in that nature. That was really fucking exciting.
Yeah. And, oh, and when you drop a teaser for these movies, that's what cements it as a real thing.
Right. But there's just varying degrees of, like, of how course, people excited people yeah, are about yeah, that real yeah. thing. No, but right. I've never seen such a level of appreciation for that a trailer than this one. I think we really nailed it. And it was really awesome. A good springboard to finish the movie from there. But back to your question about,
you that know, thing does, took a month to edit, by the way.
Does any, it really did. It took the whole month of July. We put some time and effort, and Josh is, you know, especially into that trailer.
Yeah.
But it was well worth it. But yeah, back to, like, does anyone care? I think, you know, who really did care and were committed and had belief was everyone that signed on for this film. Like, you're and right. that's what made me think, or never have that second doubt that I've, you know, maybe had dabbled in the past. Does anyone care? It's like, fuck it. If these guys believe and care, then that's all that matters. And that's what gave me that. Cause, I mean, we're talking about with, LSM, but like, if he's excited about this, and I'm definitely excited about this. And like Chris Logan, like, He was practically giving, like, these little, like, DM, like, pump-up messages, like, no one fucking sleep on this. Like, we got one chance to, like, we got one chance to make a last impression. No one – he was sending out this in group emails and, like, on Insta posts where he's like, dude, I credit him for, like, people were getting, like –
hyped up,
hype, like getting chills about it, and I was like, holy shit. So,
well, it was a call back to his football post
or during the season,
during before the season even started, and during the season as well.
Goes back to his days in the football huddle, is basically what it comes down to.
But there was a serious passion and belief that I haven't seen in years. And I mean, obviously, it comes down to making your last movie as well. But man, it was really, really incredible to have that kind of, like, just fully united front there from all these people, the skiers working on the movie. But then, like, when the movie dropped, it's been a crazy thing because I haven't dwelled a lot in the past until, you know, kind of making this podcast, but having people come up to you and they're like, oh, this impacted me or this impacted me over the years. And then even comparing it to the current movie, it's like, damn, like this has been a fucking era. Like we did make an impact and like it is level one, 20 years has been an era. And like, what? Yeah, it's undeniable. And it feels really cool to be a part of. And, this movie is definitely an exclamation point on that. So, yeah.
Yeah. The only reason that we could do a podcast like this and have it be worthwhile and be enjoyable to listen to, I think, and I hope, is because there's been a community around these movies ever since it was happening. And, like, that's what it comes down to, is that, like, there's... I say that because, like, hearing CeeLo... You talk about that, like that really drives that home for me, that he was like, dude, fuck yeah, we are going out with a bang. Like everybody get your head in the motherfucking game because like it's about to go down. Like,
yeah,
like it's not just like I like skiing and I do this for fun and it's really cool that this is my job. Like, no, like this level, like Hornbeck said at the world premiere, he was like, level one is the shit. And like the fact that not only do the people who watch these movies think that, but that the people who get to ride in front of the camera think that is what makes it all worthwhile to me.
Parker also had a pump up email. Those two, man, they're good at them. They get their head in the game. He had the pump up email because everyone was sort of patting each other's back after Zigzag came out. And he's like, no more fucking high fives. Like, we got another one to do, and this one means a lot more. Like, don't be calling it, like, don't be feeling all proud of yourself just yet.
Yeah.
So.
Got another year of work to do, boys.
Yep.
Yeah, but damn, I mean, the community is a powerful thing. Yeah, within the sphere, you know, closely that we work with and outside of it, the people that have been watching it, like I can't begin to appreciate it enough because we would not be doing it. But when I really, really enjoy showing a movie on a big screen and watching a movie with people, and you have the opportunity once a year on these annual films to do that. And this year I've been in Montana and Salt Lake and Denver and France and Switzerland and Sweden. And it's like all these different audiences have all been like the same, and there's been in the best way possible. And it's fucking beautiful. It's awesome. And I feel very honored. And,
The people in France were clapping. Yeah. Or cheering. I'm sorry. Yeah. 'Cause they clap. That's their thing.
Yeah.
But, there are a lot of quiet premieres that I've seen and been to there, but there's some noise this year.
Sometimes the quiet ones run deep, though, as they say.
Oh, they do, for sure.
They actually are watching the movie. They're not just being like,
well, how many people remember what from level one premieres in Denver?
Oh, Denver?
Like, nothing.
Denver, you know?
Like,
Denver
was a great party.
Nothing but a gathering of the tribe, which it serves its own purpose in that respect.
Yep.
But, goddamn, it's been a fun ass tradition to be part of, though.
Yeah. Congrats to both you boys and everyone who's been involved.
Yeah, there's been contributions from
big and small,
people that we could
high.
Go for hours on listing.
Yep.
Dropping names, picking them back up. But yeah.
Word. And thank you to everybody for listening, too.
Yes.
It's been awesome doing this.
Thanks, Connor.
Honor and a privilege.
Yeah.
All right, that's it. That's all, folks. Level 20 has been hosted and produced by Connor Smith. Executive producers Josh Berman and Friedel Cody. Audio mastering and technical support by Stefan Tchaikovsky. And art design by Shuey Bauman. Thank you, Level 1, for 20 amazing years. Thank you to everyone who has listened and helped us spread the word about this project. Thank you, skiing.